today on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. A webcam at Glacier National Park is trained on a sleepy black bear, which is tucked up high in a cottonwood tree and is struggling to shake off 6 months of hibernation. So why is this snoozer getting 50,000 hits a day? Because the bear is us. With estimates that 70 million people aren't getting enough sleep, the bear is totally relatable. We'll take your calls and ask you, how hard is it for you to get out of bed? Artist Julia Vogel says her mission is to put public back in public art. We'll talk to her about how she's transforming Boston Common into a common art experience for all.
At noon, Emily Rooney is here for her famous list of fixations and fulminations. For the Mashpee Wampanoags, are they still trying to seal the deal on the billion-dollar casino, or is Congress their last resort? Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leon joins us for that and more next on Boston Public Radio 89.7.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting today, as we do every Friday, from the Boston Public Library WGBH studio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
How are you?
Good. Great.
So there's a bear. I'm so into this story. There's a bear in Montana, which or who, depending on your point of view, has become an internet darling, and he doesn't even know it. A camera hundreds of feet away is trained on this wide opening and then not in a cottonwood tree at Glacier National Park. And the bear is mostly napping. After 6 months of hibernation, this bear just can't get motivated to leave its den. You might see it poke out its head, its feet. Once in a while, you can see the bear stretch. But not even a bird soaring right past it seems to jolt it out of its sleepy state. So why is this snoozer of a video averaging 50,000 hits a day, including me? Could it be because that bear is us? With the news being as grim as it is in a spring that feels and looks like winter, we're taking your calls asking you, how much do you struggle to get out of bed every day? 877-301-8970. What is your strategy? I have one. I don't know if Marjorie has one. Are you a serial snooze button abuser? Do you have multiple alarm clocks? 877-301-8970. Before we do this, can we talk about the bear for a second? How much did you love this video?
Oh, the bear, it's in this tree hole.
A knot,
50
yeah.
feet off the ground or something.
Yeah.
And you see the one little foot come out of the hole. Then you see like the 2 feet
stretching.
Come out, stretching. Yeah, the bear is stretching. Then you see his little face come out. Actually, it's a pretty big face. Kind of looks around, looking stunned. At what point after it snows, he's licking the snow off the tree. But you know what's incredible? I mean, I had no idea.
What's that?
These bears can be in their little hibernating state for as much as 100 days without eating or drinking. They don't, or doing whatever.
Whatever.
That's
exactly.
Right. Exactly. And they talk about that they're unusual in that. The other animals like marmots and chipmunks and squirrels, they do have to every few days come out and have something to eat.
I didn't know that.
Yes, but
the bear's hibernation is deeper and longer than
it is. It is deeper and longer, and they don't.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And yeah, and they keep warm because they've got this huge bulk of weight that they gain during the summer, and their fur.
So I stay warm.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Inches deep layers of fat. And apparently the fur gets much. And they put their head between their forepaws, and they keep their back to the cold because that's where they're most fur.
Did you read how long it takes? The reason we even thought of this snooze concept here, did you read how long it takes for the bear to fully wake up?
I think it's 2 weeks, isn't
it? 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
It basically, it's not quite a snooze alarm kind of thing. It's a bear version of a snooze alarm. After 6 months of hibernation, it does a 2 week snooze alarm.
Yeah, it's really cute. It's still going on now, right?
What?
It hasn't really, the 2 weeks is still
going
on now, right?
I believe that's right. So are you a snooze alarm kind of, but what's your deal?
I am.
So do you have a strategy? What do you do?
Well, I guess it's terrible. You read these stories about how the snooze button is very, very bad. We should never use it, but I use it every morning.
And it's bad because it interrupts your more valuable sleep, that deeper sleep thing. But let me tell you something. One of the great joys, and by the way, I just learned this morning, a snooze alarm came into being in 1950s. No one's 100% sure why then. But the joy of setting your alarm 10 minutes earlier than you have to get up or 20 minutes earlier and then hearing the alarm and allowing yourself to stay in bed for another 10 minutes is absolute exaltation.
I know.
I mean, it doesn't get any better. And so we want to know what your strategy is for waking up. I just can't do the alarm thing and then just pop right out of bed. We're going to talk in a few minutes about some brilliant alarm clocks, some brilliant apps that help you wake up.
Do we have to wait? I just want to mention one.
No, you can go right ahead. Go, I know. They're hard to resist.
Remember we talked about this a few years ago?
We did.
This is called the Dreddy Clocky that's terrorized homes for years now, according to the story.
This is the MIT woman's thing, is it not?
I think it's from the MIT woman. The idea is that the alarm, you have to chase it around the room.
Yeah.
Maybe even around the house, that it goes off and then it starts rolling around.
It's on
these wheels.
Yeah.
And you have to chase it. And apparently it's quite elusive. And by the time you chase it all around the house, turn it off, you're not going to go back to bed.
Well, can I match that one? I never heard of the snooze and lose till this morning. This is a thing where you input into this alarm clock your least favorite charity.
Right.
And what happens is every time you hit snooze alarm, it automatically, it's a smart alarm clock, it automatically donates $10 of your money to your least favorite charity.
That's
which
right.
I thought is pretty brilliant, too. And there's another one, since we're on it, before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970, there are a lot of apps, which I was totally unaware of for your phone. I knew there are obviously snooze alarms in your phone because I use it. But there is this thing called Wakey.
Oh,
which
yes.
allows you to be called by a live human being who is a stranger. And the theory behind it is while you'll be rude to a family member, your spouse, your partner, your kid, whatever, you wouldn't be rude to a stranger. So your phone rings, and it's a live human being who obviously works for Wakey, and he or she wakes you up and starts talking to you, and theoretically that gets you out of bed.
Oh, Sandy just emailed about a turtle that hibernates for 5 months, too. No food. No light, just sleeping. And they talk
well, that's
about...
That's essentially what the black bear does.
With this bear, how the bear's heartbeat in the fall is about 45 to 50 beats a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And in hibernation, 8 beats a minute.
Wow,
and these
amazing.
Researchers say how they can hardly hear the bear's heartbeat at all. But then when the bear's disturbed and they think there's concern, it flies up to 175 beats per minute. And sometimes it's the mother bear in hibernation with the...
Cubs,
yeah.
Oh. By the way, I could really get into hibernation. Can you? How great would that be to sleep through the winter?
I know.
Oh my God!
Yeah, you go
especially
to bed
here
right after Thanksgiving. I would say wake up in April, but since it's like 30 degrees out, still you have to make it May.
877-301-8970. We want to know what your strategy is for waking up in the morning. It's sort of a spring, an almost spring kind of concept, and it was the genesis. The idea was because of this fabulous bear cam thing out of Glacier National Park. Do you have a strategy? Is it hard for you? Are you able to do it in a way that it is painless? I've sort of created a semi-painless thing with my snooze deal. I'm really, which
well,
is
you,
with
you,
my phone.
You took things further than most of us, Jim.
What do you mean?
Jim went to a sleep doctor.
Why do you always have to mention that and ridicule me? A lot of people go, why did I go to a sleep doctor, Marjorie?
Because we used to have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well, one of us got up at 3 o'clock.
I did not.
You apparently
get up
got up at 4 o'clock.
Yeah,
we used
I got
to,
up at 4
we,
o'clock.
We were given, when Don Imus was fired by our old radio station, we were put on the morning show, which started at 6. It was 6 o'clock, right?
Started at 6.
6 o'clock. So
right.
I had to get up at 3. Marjorie, of course, got up at 4 whenever she got up. And it was really hard. And the issue...
It was terrible.
You, of course, would not have done this. I did it because I'm organized. I called every radio talk show host in Boston who you and I knew who was a 6 a.m. person, like Maddie Siegel and all these other people. I don't know who else, but I called 3 or 4 of them and said...
Lorne and Wally.
Lorne and Wally, of course. And I said, are you able on... All I want to know is on Saturdays and Sundays that I can return to a normal sleep cycle. Because I'm doing 3 a.m. Monday to Friday, I'm not going to be waking up at the end. It was half and half. And so that's why I went to a sleep doctor, a very famous sleep doctor at Harvard.
I can't believe you even got half and half.
What?
Everybody I asked said you never, ever get used to it. And all
well, maybe
you
it wasn't
about,
half and half. You're right. It's closer
all
to 70-30.
All you think about is when you're going to sleep. And it's true. It's like, you know, people say that they're dieting. When you're dieting, all you think about is food.
Yeah.
All I ever thought about was sleep. Where am I going to sleep next? Where am I going to sleep next? Where am I going
to
sleep
well,
next?
Well, you used to do, what did you do when we had the morning show?
I took naps in my car.
In the parking lot.
Right.
With your mouth open.
And in wintertime, I would have,
exactly.
That's right, with my mouth open. In the wintertime, I'd have blankets and all that kind of stuff
in your
the
car
so that I could sleep in the car.
It's rather sad.
Yeah, well, I think that was the question. Are you better off sleeping, as a lot of people do, that do morning television or morning radio or morning, whatever kind of job they have, they'll go to sleep like at 7 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
but I could never do that. So if you went to bed at 10 and had to get up at 3, you need to nap during the day to make up. And the question was whether one long sleeping period was better than napping. You said one long sleep period. I used the nap
because the woman,
approach.
The doctor I saw said the nap thing just doesn't really work for you.
Yeah,
I think
I
it's because of that deep REM, whatever the hell that is.
You know what the great thing about the nap thing? What? You have two mornings.
Well, that's actually a good thing.
877-301-8970 is our phone number. And we're talking about this black bear. Would you kind of like to hibernate by the black bear? Are you watching the black bear come out of its hibernation? Which is really pretty neat. It's like watching, as somebody just emailed, it says like that slow TV, watching the bird.
Oh, Norway. We've talked about that with that.
You have trouble getting out of the morning.
Alex.
Paul says he also does the same thing. He has the alarm clock. It's kind of like the walkie thing, where his alarm clock is 30 feet across the room. So you have to get out of bed and go turn off the alarm clock.
That's almost masochistic.
Well, you can also easily get back into bed.
You can, but it's not the same. I mean, you really want it. It has to be a little smoother kind of. And also, do you decide, do you use your phone or a clock? Do you have a specific
phone?
So you've picked an alarm that is not horribly jarring,
right?
I assume, or you don't know how to do that probably.
I do know how to do that.
I doubt
Thank
that.
You very much.
Obviously, one of her kids did it for her. 877-301-897. Let's take some calls. Connor in Boston. We're talking about bears and humans. Hi there, Connor. What's up?
Hi. So, first time I actually got in the phone.
Oh, we're thrilled.
Oh, good. Well, welcome to the
show. Hi.
Hi. So, I'm kind of stupid in terms of doing my alarm, so I actually range from, like, trying to wake up at, hello?
Yeah, we're listening.
Okay. I would have an alarm try and wake me up at 6, and it would just count down from all the alarms. What?
So what do you have, multiple alarms? Is that what you do?
Well, I have alarms that range from, like 40 different alarms from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m.
Oh, gosh.
And I finally wake up at the last one, like, oh, crap, I should have woke up at 6.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Do you miss things by waking up later than you should, or that's okay?
Well, not really missing anything, but the thing that actually really helps me, like, I have my iPhone do it, but I don't know if I made this up, if someone else should copy me, is I just put the phone on the other end of the room, so I have to physically get up.
That's what an emailer said. Connor, thanks for your first call.
Thing.
Make another one soon. But I don't
Katie
like that.
Katie says she duct tapes her alarm clock to the ceiling, so
that's
she has
not,
to stand on the bed to turn it off.
That is not true.
That's what she said.
Email her back and ask if that's made up.
That's what she says.
She duct tapes it to the ceiling so she has to stand up to do it.
And Joe thinks alarm clocks are killing us, that the key is to go to bed earlier and wake up without an alarm clock.
By the way, one of the great joys, that's another great joy. Occasionally, do you set the alarm on the weekend if you don't have anything to do or you do?
No.
How great is that?
It's great.
A natural wake-up kind of thing?
I know.
But, you know, there are a lot of people. We may hear from some in a few minutes. I wake up at 5 o'clock almost the exact same minute every day, often a couple of minutes before the alarm, I should have said. But how great is that if your internal clock or whatever they call that thing is such that even if you set the alarm, you don't need it? You just wake up naturally. How great would that be?
Well, that hasn't happened.
I should ask the sleep doctor
to a
about
lot
that.
Of us. Courtney says every morning she wakes up to the dulcet tones of Morning Edition on National Public Radio.
Oh, that's very nice.
Thank you very much for that, Courtney.
Tim in Portsmouth, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about sleep patterns inspired by this beautiful bear in Glacier National Park. Hey there.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So you just wrapped up what I was going to say. I am 66 years old.
Yep.
I haven't woken up to an alarm clock for about, probably 35 years.
What do you do?
I know I need 7 hours of sleep every night, and I try to go to bed. I go to bed about 8. I fall asleep about 9. I need to wake up at 4 because I live in the middle of New Hampshire, and I work on the coast, so I have a long commute.
Uh-huh.
I also need to walk myself and my dog for a mile every morning, myself to warm my, to stretch my body out because I broke my back and pelvis a couple of years ago and I'm still working. And so it's good physical exercise without going to the gym. And we have a young 4-year-old black lab that's got a lot of energy. So I take the dog for a walk about 5 o'clock.
But wait, stop for a second. Do you naturally wake up at 4 o'clock every day? No alarm. It just happens. You wake up
because
your body.
Yeah, because Yes, Jim, because I know I need 7 hours of sleep, and I make sure that I go to bed. This is the strategy. Perhaps the school committee would be interested in establishing with our teenagers, our high school students, that complain about not being functional in the morning. The problem is going to bed at the right time.
Well, it is, but, you know, that's a tough task, and that's why they're starting school later,
Thank
or
you.
At least proposed it in Boston. Tim, thanks.
Thank you for
Read
the
what
call.
Henry Santoro on the Comrex, our colleague, said, Marjorie. I should have thought of Henry.
Henry's done 29-plus years of morning radio. I have never hit the snooze alarm, not even once, my body clock is still not back to normal.
Oh, that's horrible. It's still not back to normal.
Well, I think he's right. I think that's what everybody said. You never get back to normal. You know, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, look at, and Henry has to do that. After all those years on the radio, he had to do that. And Joe Matthew starts work at
4:50.
4:50, so he's probably
getting
up at 2.
Some days he's trapped in the elevator. It's even worse.
Listen to this. I know that was terrible, and he had to do a show from the elevator.
It was great. He didn't have to. He did. That
was
one of the most
impressive.
Inspiring radio stories of our lifetimes.
A true journalist.
What?
Listen to this from Michelle. She
Tim,
says we should check out the wood frog. When it hibernates, its blood literally freezes, and in the spring, it thaws out. You can find time-lapse videos of the thaw online.
My God. How great is that? I hope that's true. That is a great thing. Is that not?
It's very impressive.
By the way, did we make clear, I think you did, that when the bear is hibernating, it doesn't eat, it doesn't drink, it doesn't, urinate. It
does not go to the bathroom.
Doesn't go to the bathroom.
Actually, bears don't really go to the bathroom.
What do they
but
do?
But you know what we're talking
about. Well, you know
about.
What I mean. Exactly.
And they
do
don't,
anything
they don't eat exercise either, which is also interesting because they don't get suffer bone loss. You know, if you don't...
Bone mass loss.
Right, yeah. Exactly. If you don't move for 8 months, you usually, and you're a human being, that's a problem. But apparently...
That is a problem.
It's not a problem with bears. You know who else hibernates? I didn't know this. Bats.
Bats?
Yeah. And the bear has got so much fat tissue to break down that it can go through up to 4,000 calories a day.
That's unbelievable. By the way, for this discussion, we just realized if anybody here in the studio between us and the Newsfeed Cafe would like to weigh in on the whole how does one awaken oneself kind of thing, there's the mic there. Do we have a... Oh, there's Tori, our coworker. Just go say hello to Tori. She will put you at the mic. And we'll talk to you. 877-301-8970. We spoke to Tim, did we not? Yes, we did. Let's go to Jay in Lowell. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? I'm
excellent.
So I know that everyone's still discombobulated from the time change recently, but I'd say that you have all summer to get used to it. And then when the fall back happens, just don't sleep in. Get up at the same time, and now you're an hour earlier every day than what you're used to. And it suddenly becomes a lot easier to get up early in the morning.
So what's the strategy? But how do you do that? What is the strategy? I know
because when the fall back happens, normally let's say you get up at 8 o'clock. Well, suddenly now that will be 6 or 7 o'clock. So when you get up at what used to be 8 o'clock, you're now getting up at 7 o'clock. So you're actually an hour earlier than you need to be. And you just adopt that now your wake up time is at 7 a.m. And so you have a little bit of time to, not.
Oh,
get
I got
up.
It. I got it. Well, that's really creative, Jay. Thank you for your contribution. We appreciate it.
Kim says her Maine Coon, Flick, walks up and down her back at exactly 6 a.m., his breakfast time, every morning, and wakes her up. That's a good one.
Didn't we get a phone call yesterday after Jess Kensky and Patrick Downs left us? Did we get a phone? Was this on the air? I can't remember. Where somebody said she and her sister or something used to go to school with their dog every day.
Yes.
The dog went home, and then at 2:20, the dog left home and greeted them at 2:30.
Listen to this.
So can animals tell? Can they tell time?
Well, you've heard all those stories about the people, those sad stories about the owner dies.
Oh, I don't want to hear about that.
The dog keeps going to the train station for 7 years, the time the owner usually came back from work. Oh, my God. I'm sorry I said that.
Why did you tell that story?
I don't know. Listen to this one. Dan. Oh, poor Dan. Dan has a two-hour drive to work every morning. He gets up at 1:20 in the morning, in the middle of the night, every day. But his alarm is set for 1:35, so he's conditioned to get up at 1:20 in the morning. Boy, that's even worse. Can you imagine getting up at 1:20 in the morning? I have to shoot myself.
Well, actually, you know who gets up at midnight every our buddy who does morning TV with the dogs and who lives in Maine, Randy.
Randy Price
told us, I think on the air, that because he lives in Maine, he would get up at midnight. At midnight to drive down from Maine to do his morning show.
One thing that helps is there's no traffic.
Yeah, that is a plus.
I mean, it's amazing. I would get all the way from Brookline to Dorchester in 15 minutes. It was unbelievable because there was no traffic at that time in the morning. Let's go to Natalie in Woburn. What do you think, Natalie?
Hey, Natalie.
Hi. Thank you guys for taking my call.
Sure.
So I started working for an online teaching company that I teach kids in China. So I am actually working opposite hours from where I live.
Oh, my gosh.
So I wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning while my kids are sleeping, and I teach from basically 4 a.m. until 8 a.m. I have no commute, so that's great. But I do this 7 days a week, so I work through the weekends. And I actually, this is my first week that I'm taking off in 6 months, and my body just can't get back to sleeping in. I've managed to sleep until about 5 a.m., but that's still pretty early for most people. But I've gotten to a point now where I don't need a sound alarm. I actually just have a vibrate alarm so I don't wake my husband up. And I hear it once, I wake up, and my body's ready to go. And it's pretty amazing what your body gets used to. I never thought I'd be able to do this.
You know, Natalie, what you just reminded me of, which I meant to say earlier, is one of the things I read this morning, which was arguing in favor of a snooze alarm, which you apparently don't need, even though most scientists are saying it's bad for you because you break up your deeper sleep, is that it takes a certain amount of time for your body to warm to the temperature that it should be at to sort of re-enter the world. So do you have any of those issues when you just do the vibrate thing and you're up and ready to go or no?
Well, I give myself enough time to kind of wake up in bed. So I don't snooze, I don't go back to sleep, but I do give myself about 10 minutes to kind of wake my body up, and then I have time to eat breakfast and get moving before I actually
sound
start
so organized.
So that's why I wake up much earlier than I need
Natalie,
to.
Before you go away, I couldn't make out what you said at the beginning. The kids you teach in China, what do you teach them again?
I'm teaching them English.
Oh, great.
So kids who want to learn English, it's one-on-one courses. It's been fun. It's been interesting, and I'm learning a whole new culture.
That's great. Natalie, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
We're talking about the daily struggle to get out of bed, asking you if you can relate, like the hibernating bear who has become a symbol of our sleep deprivation crisis and an internet sensation as the hibernating bear wakes up over 2 weeks. We're going to keep talking about this on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about a webcam at Glacier National Park. It's trained on this sleepy black bear, which is tucked up high in a cottonwood tree, and it's struggling to shake off 6 months of hibernation. Apparently, it takes 2 weeks, according to the Washington Post story that accompanied it. This feed is averaging 50,000 hits a day, and that's because who can't relate to that bear's reluctance to get out of bed? 877-301-8970. Is the bear us, essentially? Do you have a similar struggle? What is your strategy of getting out of bed? You know, the medical director of the Sleep Disorders Center, Prescott Valley in Flagstaff, Arizona, says if you doze after your first alarm, which I do, your body gears up for another full cycle of sleep. When the second alarm jerks you awake during the beginning of your next sleep cycle, that incomplete cycle can leave you with worse sleep inertia, which I don't experience. It's actually, maybe it's everybody's body type is different. And LJ tweets us and says, my dad was in the Navy in World War II. He was never able to sleep more than 4 hours at a time for the rest of his life. You know, when I met you, I used to sleep like 4 or 5 hours a night. You always used to say, I don't know how you exist on that kind of thing. I am sleeping a lot more these days. It totally changes your life. I mean, while you do have less time to do things, more sleep is just...
How does it totally change your life? You're not exhausted
you feel,
all the time?
Well, I don't know how exhausted I was. I think it was fair. It feels great. It feels great. The expectation of it is great. Knowing you don't have to wake up in 4.5 hours, which causes some level of anxiety. Or
oh,
at least
huge
it for
anxiety.
Me. And it just physically, I feel worlds better than I did when I was getting much less.
You know, we get on this subject because this hibernating bear, this bear coming out of hibernation has become kind of an internet sensation. They've got these cameras looking
bear
at the
cam.
Tree.
Yep.
Yeah, bear cam. And you can see the little, sometimes it sticks its foot out, sometimes its head and stuff like that. But they talk about, this is so fascinating. You think of how Mother Nature came up with all this stuff. that you know, the mother bears obviously could, they will hibernate with the bears, and the baby bears will just nurse during the wintertime. But they talk about how if the mother bear has not accumulated enough fat by the time she settles into her den to hibernate, the egg will not implant itself.
Wow.
that enables her to have babies. Mm. They talk about delayed implantation. So there's this signal that she has accumulated enough fat so that she can support the baby's nursing all
you mean
winter
signal
long.
Signal to herself.
Signal to her body.
Uh-huh.
So if she's pregnant, if she's got a fertilized egg in her womb, which she can carry around for a while, it won't attach itself to the uterine wall to begin developing into the fetus until the mother bear has accumulated enough fat to assure that during hibernation she can feed
that is amazing.
The babies. And if she hasn't gotten fat enough, the egg will just never attach itself, spontaneously abort, and she won't get pregnant, you know, again for the next year. Isn't that incredible?
It is totally incredible.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the mother bear doesn't eat at all. It's just the baby bears will be nursing during the wintertime.
877-301-8970. But we're not really talking about the bear, even though we'd love to if you have been checking out the bear cam. We're talking about how the bears are us and what our practices are to come out of our daily hibernations in the morning. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Let's go to Tim in Providence. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Nice talking to you both again.
Thank you so much.
You're okay. Well, I'll make this quick. All I hear is negative motivation. The Puritan strain in New England is alive and well, chasing alarm clocks and animals walking on you. No one's mentioned coffee. When the coffee maker goes on and you hear it gurgling, you want that first cup, and that's a positive motivation to get you out of bed.
That's a good one, to time your coffee from the night before so it goes off and starts percolating at the same time every morning. That's a great one.
By the way, I can't believe you said that. Well, I don't have a timer as such. What I started doing, exactly like you talk about a year ago, is I'd prepare the coffee pot so that all I had to do when I went downstairs is hit the button, which means as opposed to a five-minute enterprise, it's maybe a 90-second enterprise until I can have it. So I am totally with you, Tim. Tim, thanks for calling. And by the way, once again, Tori is still hanging out over there. If you want to talk to us on the show, just walk over to our coworker, Tori, by the mic in between the Newsfeed Cafe and Marjorie and me, and we'd love to have you on the
show.
Now,
listen to this. If you're in a position to design your own house, this is what Sharon and her husband did. Their house was designed in the woods with a master bedroom on the top floor, a giant window facing south, so that, just the bed, nightstand, no TV or anything like that. But each morning, the sun comes up and
naturally
shines
wakes
into
them?
The window.
Was it like a feng shui kind of experience?
I don't know.
Experience?
Each morning, the rising sun comes through, first the east and then the south window, and wakes us up naturally. First thing we see is the morning sun. The second, the top of the trees.
Oh, my God.
I know. That would be nice, huh?
You know what also helps with that couple? They don't have jobs. So it's really a big plus.
Yeah. You know what I see is my neighbors. You know, it's funny if you see your neighbor's lights on in the middle of the night. You ever wake up in the middle of the night?
By the way.
What are they doing over there?
People don't know this about mm-hmm. you.
I spy on my neighbors?
You are a spy. No, it's not just your neighbors. You talk about how when you walk down the street, you're looking in people's houses kind of thing.
I love to spy.
What is the thing with that?
Well, I love to see how people decorate their houses. Yeah, you know, I'm not much of a decorator myself, so I'm always looking at other people, how they fix their houses. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things about walking the dog is you could especially my old neighborhood where there are a lot of houses on the first floor, you could look into their first floors.
Let me give you a little decorating advice, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. I think after a year, if you take the plastic off the new furniture, no, it's really, I've always found it to be much more comfortable, even if it isn't that much worth. Thank you very much. Let's go to Andrea. You're in Beverly. You're on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm on the other side of everything. I've worked in restaurants for 22 years. Mm-hmm. I started at 14. And so when I had my daughter 2 years ago, everyone said, oh, well, you know, your time clock will change. It'll turn around. Don't worry. It'll fix itself. But I'm up till 1 in the morning. I cannot put my brain off. I cannot sleep. The mornings are excruciating for me. No amount of coffee, nothing. My brain is in a fog completely till about 10 o'clock, which used to be my old schedule.
So wait a second, you're not working in a restaurant anymore, but you can't shake the old schedule? Is that what you're saying?
I can't. I haven't worked in restaurants in 2 years. I had my daughter 2 years ago.
Wow.
I'm 38 now. And
that's
I
horrible.
Think just 20 years of having the same schedule, you know, closing up the restaurants 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock at night, getting home, winding down till 2, and then sleeping till 8 or 9.
But isn't that part of that, Andrea? They say some people are morning people and some people are night people. Like I always thought, you know, when I had to write stories and really concentrate, it was so much easier for me to do it in the morning than at night. And one of my kids is just the opposite. You know, she can do everything at night. That might be that just the way you are kind of wired, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's definitely truth to it. But you'd think after switching a schedule when you
you'd
think your body might accommodate you after a while, but it's not accommodating at all.
By the way, the significance
really
of that phone call, though, is it should instruct to some degree, if Andrea is not atypical, and I don't know if she is, it should instruct people in what kinds of jobs they take at the early part of their work lives, because as Andrea, it may affect you for years to come. Andrea, thanks so much for your call.
Well, the gentleman that called about teenagers sleeping, though, that they're wired to stay up very late and to sleep late in the morning. I mean, you know, if you have kids that are 14 and 15 and 16 years old, on the weekends they'll sleep until 1 o'clock and they don't have something to do. It's amazing.
Let's go take a couple of more before we move on. Alan Middleborough, you're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Al.
How you doing today, guys?
Excellent. Thank you.
I wake up, I bought an alarm clock. It was a little bit more money, but I bought an alarm clock that has nature sounds.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
I wake up to like the babbling brook or like the birds chirping or something.
Wait,
like
is that,
that
really true? I mean, I have that on my phone, and I listened to it when I was changing my alarm about 6 months ago. Does that really wake you up, or does that just soothe you into more sleep?
It wakes. I can't, like, I. My grandmother had one of those Big Ben alarm clocks.
Yeah.
It just rang the bell. And that's the most horrible way.
No, it is jarring. I know. It is jarring.
You know, it's like a fire alarm going on.
Yeah. So you probably feel more soothed when you start your day, right,
Babbling
Al?
Book's not waking me, let me tell you right now.
I get that. I get that.
Al, thanks for the
By
call.
By the way, listen to a couple of these alarm clocks. This is called the puzzle alarm clock.
Which is this one?
And here's what it does. To wake you from your sleep, this alarm shoots off brightly colored blocks.
Oh, that's relaxing.
And you have to find the blocks and then reassemble them in their correct space on the clock before the alarm will turn off. Can you imagine doing that every morning?
That's really relaxing.
I mean, I'd want to shoot myself.
That's a great way to start
then,
your day, I think.
There's the helicopter clock.
What is that?
And what this
does... Oh,
that's
does, like a little drone coming out of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've seen that.
The alarm, when the alarm goes off, like the top of the helicopter starts darting and flying around the room, and it can fly into all your stuff if you have to, you know, be careful you don't have stuff that's fragile up there. And it won't stop until you grab this thing, which could be flying quite high above your head, and put it back onto the clock. Can you imagine that? I mean, that's kind of like torture in the morning.
Yeah, I could use an alarm clock that toasts a bagel, spreads cream. Do you ever watch Wallace? You like Wallace and Gromit, I hope.
I love Wallace and
Gromit.
You
remember Wallace and Gromit, the invention they had where the ejector bed, which would inject him and would automatically dress him. Then there was one of those fire poles that got him downstairs. The toast was in his hand.
I got one
That's
more.
That's what we all need. What is it?
The laser target clock.
What is that?
This is one where you have to hit the bullseye with your little fake gun at the crack of dawn. Otherwise, you're not going to stop the alarm clock. Can you imagine that one,
no,
too?
No, I can't. Let's take one last quick call. Edward and Milton, you're going to end it for us here on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Thank you very much. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you for both things. What's up?
I don't use an alarm clock. I wake up at the same time every day, about 7 o'clock. I have nowhere to be. I work from home. But what made me want to call is I just got a new mattress that has a sleep tracker app. And I wake up every day to an email that tells me all about my previous night's sleep.
What does that mean, all about? I'm afraid to ask.
It gives me a grade on a scale of 100. Like, I'm averaging about an 84. It tells me that I slept 8 hours and 15 minutes. How much of that was deep sleep, REM sleep, light sleep? How many times I got up? I have no idea how this thing even knows, other than that I got out of the bed and came back. But
do you like it? Does that make you feel better, or does that make you feel neurotic about your sleep?
It's made it like it's my mission. I go to bed early because I'm dying to like get more sleep. I want to see if I can get a 90. You know, it's been great motivation because, you know, like I say, I get up the same time every day. So to get more sleep, you have to go to bed early. I don't sleep in.
Okay.
So,
Edward, before you go away, how much does a mattress like this cost? Not that I'm about to go get one. How much does it cost?
It was $2,700, and then I found it cheaper online, so they gave me $300 back. Jordan's Furniture, can't beat it.
Smart mattress. Okay, Edward, thank you much for the call.
You know, they actually do have, like, the Wallace and Gromit. You were talking about the ejector beds.
Yeah.
They have them.
Wait, in real life, or
well,
is that a joke?
Well, that's what they said.
I don't know. I saw that. I don't know if that's a joke.
You thought that was real, or you
think
that was a joke?
I don't know.
Ejector bed. Just shoots you right across the room.
That's great. Shoots you right into your car, right? Or if it misses right against the wall, that'll wake you up.
Yeah, can you imagine?
Now, that's a wonderful way to go to bed, knowing you're going to be ejected from it in 7 hours.
Okay.
That'd be really
coming up. We're going to talk with Julia Vogel. She's truly putting public back in public art with this interactive experience, which is really cool.
Remember Jared was wearing one of these things a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
She is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. This week, President Trump has been fast-tracking his America First agenda by cracking down on all things immigration. This only emphasizes the message of Julia Vogel's public art installation, Pathways to Freedom, which features thousands of perspectives on immigration, freedom, family history from people in Greater Boston. It's been commissioned by the Jewish Arts Collaborative. Julia, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Jared Bowen was raving about your project on our show a couple of weeks ago, so we're thrilled to hear about it.
Okay, so tell us what it is you're doing.
So I've created Pathways to Freedom, which is kind of a two-phase operation. One is that I have this trolley that you can see that I brought to the studio today that I'm going to take to 26 locations all over the city, and I'm asking people four multiple-choice questions about freedom and immigration. And based on their answers, they get different colored stickers that they get to put on a button. And they get to walk off into the world with their button. And hopefully that will coax other conversations with family members or strangers. And then I get a digital copy of their button that I'm going to enlarge as a print and place on the Boston Common at the base of Soldiers and Sailors Civil War Monument.
Hey, by the way, these things are called encounters. Is that what you call these 20-plus things? And ultimately, is April 25th to May 2nd is when you're on the Common?
Yeah.
So what's the concept? I mean, I understand you have the digital replicas of whatever you call them buttons? Buttons,
yep.
Yes. What's the statement that's being made?
Well, the concept is that by going everywhere from City Hall to I'm going to be at the Dudley Cafe tomorrow, all across the city, asking people these questions about freedom and immigration, we're going to show how unique and diverse Boston is and their perspectives on this issue. And then the hope is to also show how we're also united, that we all do have feelings about this and that. And also thinking about the new American narrative.
Yeah.
You know, what does that look like? Looking at our past, looking at how we're feeling now, what's the message we want to say about what it means?
And
the
button that you have on your sweater right now, those are the buttons that everybody leaves with that answers your four questions. But they don't say things on them. They're just, the idea is that they'll see you with this button and say, what's the deal with the button?
Exactly.
Okay. And then people will explain it, and then the concept will expand beyond the person that actually took the quiz.
But what's the representation? What are the different representations
so
mean?
So you guys can make a button too, but basically there are seven images on your button. One is the answer to the first question, which is, when did you or your family come to the Boston area? And I've used Boston City landmarks for that answer. So if you say pre-1788, you're going to get the SS Constitution on your pin. But if you say 2016 to today, you're going to get a view from the BU Bridge of the skyline.
Oh.
So we have different landmarks across the city representing different immigration patterns across Boston's history.
Uh-huh.
And then the second question is, when do you feel free? And the answers are yes, no, wow, I have to think about that. And the answers are like traffic lights. We have red, green
and
amber.
Yep. Oh, that's great.
And then we have, when do you feel free? And the imagery for that actually is a bar chart of the amount of refugee boats that have come from Turkey to Greece. I went to Lesbos to do research for this project. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Stop there for a second. What was that like? That's where people coming mostly from Africa?
They're coming from all over the world. We had people from Congo, Syria, even Dominican Republic. And it was extraordinary. And I braced myself almost to be devastated, but I actually was really inspired by how brave these people are to start a new life. So, I went there to do research about what that is, what that feels like. And so I've incorporated some of that in this project, too, to think about the global nature of this issue.
And what's the fourth question?
And the fourth question is,
because I'm nervous already, so go ahead.
The fourth question is, if freedom was a food, what would it be symbolized as? This project is based on the Jewish holiday of Passover, where we take a lot of food and we give them very big concepts, like matzah becomes the bread of affliction. So here I have the options ranging from clean drinking water all the way to ice cream. And the imagery for that is actually a photograph of the Freedom Trail, because obviously when you're in Boston and everyone, you mention freedom, they're like, have you been to the Freedom Trail? So it's a big symbol for moments of freedom. So
you know, Julia Vogel, when Jared mentioned you, I was looking you up a couple of weeks ago, and the term social sculpture comes up with you all the time. Most people like me see creation of art as a solitary endeavor. You're exactly the opposite. If you're not, almost everything you've done is engaging others into whatever the project is and the ultimate product, yes?
Yes.
And so give us examples, pre-Pathways to Freedom. What kind of things have you done?
I've done everything from, I was just in Hull, England, where I worked with 2,500 volunteers who were part of the City of Culture program, and asked them what it felt like to be a volunteer and their impact on the city. And collectively, we made 688 jars full of colored sand to represent their experience. I have.
And where did you put those jars of sand?
They were at Humber Street Gallery. They were in a kind of city-funded gallery.
Neat.
There. Yeah. And I've done everything from go to Krakow and take a pretzel trolley and go all over town asking people how they identify. A lot of my projects are about identity and about getting people to think and do something fun and be creative, but also be part of a collective project.
Is Boston supporting this thing? I'm a huge public. I mean, I don't know much about it, but I love public art and I love creative public art. We talk about it whenever we can on the show. Has Boston, the city of Boston, embraced this thing?
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten overwhelming at least amount of support wherever we go. This project was about going to all the different neighborhoods that make up Boston. In Passover, you say, welcome the stranger. I feel like I've really been welcomed. I'm not from Boston. So everywhere that we've gone, whether it be the Conservatory Lab School in Dorchester, we went to Raw Arts in Lynn, people have really opened their doors and welcomed me in and been excited to be part of the project.
So when we see this up on Boston Common, describe to people what we're going to see.
So it's going to be probably a 5,000 square foot floor mural that you'll be able to come to and not only be able to take your button and try and find a like pizza-shaped sized version of your button on the ground, but you'll also be able to see yourself in context of the other 1,500 or 2,000 people that I speak to and kind of compare and be a data visualizer. I'm not going to just make a bar chart of all the information. You have to come and look for it and find patterns and...
Oh, that's kind of neat. So can we do this solving thing? A puzzle.
Yeah, you can come make a button.
Ask her the questions first, because I'm anxious about this whole thing. Let me tell you right now.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, so when did you or your family come to the Boston area?
Do we mean Boston or do we mean come to America?
Boston.
Oh, Boston. I guess I came to Boston in 1982 or something.
Okay. Do you feel free? Yes, no, wow, I have to think about it.
Well, if I had a bigger pension, I might feel free.
Oh, my God. That's not one of the answers, Marjorie,
this
and
is
the
not
multiple
about,
choice
experience. I think that's not very high-minded. I think if I had more money, I'd feel free. So maybe, what should I say, maybe?
Wow, I have to think about that?
Wow, I have to think about that.
By the answer, in the era of the defined benefit pension, it would have been yes for Marjorie. But unfortunately,
right.
That is no
That's
longer
right.
with us for the most part. Okay, next.
I feel free when I vote, I get to play outside, when I don't worry about money, when I can spend time doing whatever I want, whenever I want, or I go to bed at night and feel safe.
I think when I can do whatever I want, whenever I want.
She actually, her real answer was the money answer, but she felt she was going to sound really
well,
creepy if I did
two
in a row.
In a row. It's true.
Okay, and the last question: yeah. If freedom was a food, it would be symbolized as, and we have clean drinking water, safe and something you can rely on, or all-you-can-eat buffet,
oh.
Lots of choices and diverse opportunity, my grandmother's signature dish, comforting and traditional, ripe fruit worth waiting for. Bread fresh from the oven, nourishing for body and soul, or ice cream, sweet but tricky to hold on to.
I know what she's going to say. Can I say what you're going to say?
What,
fresh bread? Coming right out of the oven.
I do
right?
love fresh bread straight out of the oven. I'm not sure if it's connected with freedom, but it sure is connected with something delicious to eat that I absolutely adore, slathered with butter and honey.
So you're going to produce, now, based
so,
on
those,
those
are
answers.
Your answer, so if those are your answers, so you... So this, the app now shows you an image of what your pin is going to look like, which is right here. And I see it.
I can see it.
And then if you give me 2 seconds, I will get you stickers, and then you get to make a pin that looks just like that right here.
Okay.
By the way, Julia Vogel is actually doing this. This is not like a mock kind
of
deal.
But of course, if I had just arrived here, or if my family was a recent immigrant from someplace, my answers would be probably much deeper. and different.
I thought they were quite deep, actually.
They weren't really very deep at all. I would have said initially that my symbolized, you know what food would symbolize freedom for me?
I would say a plain donut from Dunkin' Donuts.
Pizza.
A pizza.
Don't you think about pizza? I mean, if you could eat any one thing and just kind of...
No, nobody thinks pizza.
They don't?
So what is she supposed to do with those things?
Okay,
okay.
I put it on
so
my car.
So now she has 7 stickers, and I actually gave you 2 bonus stickers here,
too. Oh, thank you.
Very and nice. The bonus stickers represent... one of them is actually a section of the U.S. Visa immigration stamp.
Oh, gosh.
And everybody gets that kind of as a symbol of the reality of immigration today.
Yep.
And the other one is the skies and seas of... kind of the that we cross when we immigrate.
Yep, the beautiful blue, 2 shades of blue. That's
and
beautiful.
And then the final one that you have, which I just need to find here.
Why does one have the MBTA symbol?
Well, that was my landmark for 1965 to 2000.
Oh, okay. All right, okay.
And that was the major moment when basically... that was 1965 was a really big year for immigration into Boston.
Oh, it was?
If you look at the stats,
that
was a really big landmark year.
By the way, and that's perfect, because the last time the tea was on time was 1965, so that's actually
well, I was gonna
that's
say,
a perfect
I would have taken the tea here in 1982, but I walked faster, and I got here, right to the
Back
Bay
thank
before
you very
the
much.
Tea could drop me at the Copley Station.
Marjorie, you did very well.
Yeah,
are you
going to
put
you.
The things on your little
yes,
deal?
Yes, and then the last one is that you encountered me here, so every place I go gets a different... one.
Okay. Oh, I love this. This
so,
is very pretty.
Yeah, they just peel off and you get to put them on and then that's you.
Should I put it in any color order? Does it matter?
Nope. It's
okay.
up to you.
Okay.
And then, Marjorie, what you can do is hold it up to the microphone so the people listening on the radio can see it
okay.
At the end
right.
of the thing.
Okay, Smarty Pants, why don't you take the quiz and then you can see how you do.
Julie Vogel,
you're,
can
I
do
what
this,
you're
please?
Say about
yes.
freedom.
Marjorie, can I answer my own questions, please? Thank you. That's part of what freedom is,
you
to be able to
my
answer your own damn
me.
Questions.
The bread one. I know
okay,
what your
Julia.
Answer is going to be.
Okay, actually, here's what we're going to do. You asked me the question. Marjorie is going to suggest which. Is this according to the rules okay?
Sure.
She's going to guess what my answer is going to
well,
be.
I know the one about food.
Marjorie, can we do them one at a time, please? It's public art.
And then you'll correct? Like, you'll correct?
I will not correct.
Okay.
I will do. Yes, I guess I will correct. Okay, what's the first question again,
when
please?
Did you or your family come to the Boston area?
Do you have any idea when I came here?
I would say about the same time as me, about 1980.
86.
86, okay.
85, 86, whatever.
Do you feel free? Yes, no, wow, I have to think about it.
Okay, Marjorie, what's the answer?
Yes.
Yes. Boy, that's such a condescending... Because you think I'm not self-aware. That's why you said that was such condescension.
I didn't say that, Jim. You said
that. That is exactly what it was. Okay, what's the third one?
I feel free when I vote, I get to play outside, when I don't worry about money, when I can spend time doing whatever I want, whenever I want, or I go to bed at night and feel safe.
Go ahead, Marjorie.
Well, I don't think it's when I play outside. That would... that would
not an
be
outdoors
a,
kind
the,
of guy.
What's the first one?
I vote.
Oh, well, I'll say when I vote.
That is what I was going to say, actually. I was going to say
there
when
you go.
I vote.
There
Thank you
Jim
very much.
A big patriot.
I am in lots of ways. And what is the fourth question?
And the fourth
please?
Question is about food.
This is so easy.
If freedom was a food.
Go ahead. Let's see options again,
it's
please.
It's the all-you-can-eat buffet.
Well, can we hear the options, please, before?
Clean drinking water, all-you-can-eat buffet, my grandmother's signature dish, ripe fruit, red, fresh from the oven, or ice cream?
Well, obviously, Marjorie, you know the fresh fruit would be. No, that is not it. All you can eat. I live, Julia, you don't know me, to go to the all you can eat buffet. So is that a bad answer? Is
no,
that okay?
it's been really great. We had a young student who said, you don't have sushi on here. And I said, maybe you could find that at the all
you
can eat buffet. So
could.
It's our catch all.
How did I do?
Here.
Like
great.
A B minus?
Well, now you can
okay?
see. Well, I feel like everybody is an A plus.
I knew you'd
when
say
you
that.
Do that.
Go ahead.
So
what
okay.
does this look like?
I've got my button on.
By the way, this is great. And can you describe exactly, because most people are not here, they're listening. Describe what this whole thing is from which you were pulling these
so
things
it's,
and generating
it looks a little
button.
Bit like a lemonade stand meets an ice cream stand.
Exactly.
I have lots of cups with different colored stickers. Everybody always thinks I'm selling food or candy. And then in front of it, I have an iPad tray that 2 people can come up to and engage.
What was the genesis of this idea? Before you pull the sticker, or as you pull, what was the genesis of this idea? Was that your head?
You mean for the whole project?
For this project, yes.
So the Jewish Arts Collaborative had heard about my practice and said, we want to do a project about on the themes of Passover, but all over Boston. Mm-hmm. Let's make this not just about the Jewish community, but make it accessible to everyone. And that conversation started in August 2016 when I was really involved with volunteering with refugees in London. which is a lot more of a prevalent thing on the streets than it is maybe mm-hmm. here in Boston. And then, of course, Trump got elected, and the word immigration suddenly started to have negative connotations. And I'm a first-generation American, so for me, immigration has always been a point of pride for me. And I thought, what if we go out and ask everybody, you know, what their relationship That's is great. To this term and to the concept of freedom, and get people starting to talk about that.
You know, I'm when you ask people who are in the United States, but they're not here, they're not citizens because they can't become citizens, or maybe they came here illegally, when you ask them about freedom, what kind of things do they say?
So another portion of this is that we're doing audio interviews as well, where we are asking people, what's one thing that makes you, prevents you from feeling free? What's one thing that makes you feel free? And we have had people who feel frustrated that they've been here for 10 years and they're still not a citizen and they can't vote. But we've also had a lot of people who feel really empowered by so many people being activists right now and being able to speak out, and freedom of speech is still so prevalent.
Is the audio going to be part of the project
that
will be on the Common?
It is.
Oh, that's great.
So you can
that's
hear people
fabulous.
When you go up there, too.
You can hear different
that's
voices.
Great. Well, this is going to be fantastic. I'm going to explain. It's going to be participatory part, wraps up this Sunday, but the installation is going to be on Boston Common April 25th through May 2nd, so you have a bunch of time to go up there and see it. This is a brilliant idea.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Yeah. And where are you in tomorrow, you said?
Yeah, tomorrow I'm at Dudley Cafe
what
from
time?
1 to 3.
1 to 3.
So if you Great. Want to make a button, come down.
Great.
Okay.
And I'm also at the Peabody Essex on Sunday from 11 to 4.
Oh, fantastic.
One of our favorite places. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Julia, it's great to meet you. Thanks for
having me.
The public art installation, which has been commissioned by the Jewish Arts Collaborative, is entitled Pathways to Freedom. One more time, you can take in the installation at Boston Common April 25th through May 2nd. To learn more about all this, go to jartsboston.org/pathways. Julia, thank you very much for
thank
coming
you.
In. Coming up, we're going to talk to Emily Rooney. She's here for her famous list of fixations, fulminations. Emily Rooney is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
At noon on BPR Live from our GVH studio at the Boston Public Library. On local TV stations across the country, news anchors have been delivering the exact same message about the dangers of fake news. And what they're being forced to say is people asking who those stations are really serving. Emily Rooney joins us for a take on this. Plus, we'll of course get her famous list of fixations and fulminations.
Is it time to throw the MBTA under the bus with reports of its absentee drivers causing major delays? Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young joins us for that and more. And if you think summer in New England will never happen, Amy Traverso gives us hope with a preview of Weekends with Yankees, surfing, sun, and the search for the perfect lobster roll. Then Sue O'Connell explains why we nearly broke the internet by Googling the image of an MIT architecture professor. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Friday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Now, while you were busy gossiping with Emily Rooney,
did
you hear Henry Santoro mention there's going to be an inch of snow this afternoon?
No.
Is that true?
That is just
no, spring is going very well.
Here with us for her famous list of fixations and fulminations is Emily Rooney. Emily, of course, is host of Beat the Press, which you can catch for, oh, you're taping today here.
No, you keep saying that.
Oh, sorry.
They keep doing,
sorry.
We're going to be back on May 11th.
Sorry, which
May
is
11th.
Not taping here this afternoon.
May 11th.
Three.
We'll be
May
here.
11th, Friday, May 11th, but you can watch her tonight at 7 o'clock on Channel 2. Hello there, Emily Rooney.
Hey, J.M.A. March.
Hello, Emily Rooney. Great to talk to you. Let's talk a little bit about the president. He kind of had this...
What a day yesterday.
As Jim called it earlier, an explosion of incorrect information foaming out of his mouth down in West Virginia. Do we have some sound from some of
yeah,
those?
Yeah, actually, here's one piece
Put
of it.
Put the sound together, Jim.
He's falsely claiming, for starters, that millions of people, that his word, as you'll hear, voted illegally in California. Everybody knows it. Here he is.
In many places, like California, the same person votes many times. You probably heard about that. They always like to say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Not a conspiracy theory, folks. Millions and millions of people. And it's very hard because the state guards their records. They don't want to see it.
You know, before we go down the litany of things that where he did make misrepresentations yesterday, like the caravans in Mexico all that stuff, and that, quote, women are being raped at levels no one's ever seen before. I mean, this sickness, it is really horrible for democracy. I hate to be overly serious about someone who everybody knows makes stuff up. When you say, and you're the president of the United States, that millions of people voted illegally or twice, that is a horrible
and
statement about American democracy when it comes from the leader of the country.
Don't want you to see it? That's totally inaccurate. All states' federal voting records are federal documents. They're totally open.
Right. What is true, which has nothing to do with this, when he put together that cockamamie voting fraud commission, most states correctly, their secretaries of state, Republicans or Democrats, would not release the kind of records they want.
Yeah,
but the
right.
basic information
yes.
about voting
and
is publicly
totally
available.
And it's totally disproven. He was saying that busloads and busloads of people from New York were going to Pennsylvania. It never happened. The traffic commissioners, you know, confirmed that. It didn't happen.
But you know what? He's winning. I mean, we talked about a poll earlier this week that said, what is it, up to 70% of Americans now are questioning the veracity of the so-called mainstream news media and buying. They didn't say 70% of the people
it
are buying.
It said some or all
theories.
Is fake news in mainstream media.
Yeah, and who knows how many people are buying these lunatic conspiracy theories that are espoused by people like Alec Jones and Breitbart and some of these other
well,
websites.
It's even gotten worse than that because those guys are so far off the rails that isn't funny, but there's this whole in-between group that really promotes stuff like that, like
Fox
Laura Ingraham
News.
And, you know, Sean Hannity and, yeah.
Well, like these caravans things, the implication being
story.
That there are, what, don't tell me.
No.
Okay.
I'm doing it tonight because originally the mainstream press was skeptical that anything like this even existed. So that took a little bit of time. And it was actually a BuzzFeed reporter who was there who verified that there were 1,500 Hondurans heading through central Mexico, heading to Mexico City. Many of them wanted to come into the United States. He was kind of... He said two-thirds of them wanted to come into the United States. The Breitbart guy was the one who said, no, actually, it's a movement. They do it every year, and it's a religious and a cultural and a political movement to show how desperate the situation is.
And it's going on for 5 years.
But the president conflated it with DACA. No, caravan busted up. No more DACA. What's it got to do with that? You got to be in the United States to have DACA. What are you talking
well,
about?
Well, not only that. I mean, by the way, we mentioned that a few days ago, and I think everybody knows this. When he was saying they were crossing the border, forget the caravans, so that they could participate in DACA, you had to be here in 2007. He was only off by 11 years to be able to qualify for DACA. Women, this not only is this amazingly inarticulate, there's no evidence from anybody, the Mexican government, the caravan itself, news reporters. Women are being raped at levels no one's ever
That's
seen before.
That's not true. These are mostly young families with children.
With
the
children,
men
exactly.
are traveling with the men. They're all dressed nicely. They have stuff with them. They're not, you know, poor, tired refugees. They're looking for... Most of them are worried about their lives in Honduras.
Well, they are poor, tired refugees in the sense of that they are leaving in desperation.
Well, that's true.
And you
but
know,
they have money.
Out.
They're buying bus tickets.
Yeah, but they're sleeping out in the on the desert
well, they
or
got,
getting
they
poured
got,
on in the rain.
They got stuck there. That's another thing. They were forced to stop there. They were going to keep moving. Instead, they got forced to stop, and that's why they were sleeping in that open... arena,
but you know what I do now, and I know this is imprecise, and I don't have any skills in this area. When he says things, no, in the area I'm about to say, theoretically, I have some skills in this area, not many. When he was talking about the millions, I watched his face. I watched it a couple times last night to say, which I'm sure we all do, does he know that this is just absolutely
no, he doesn't.
Made up, or no. is he so convinced
he
himself?
It.
And that's where I am.
Yeah.
That he believes
it.
He believes
well,
people were crossing for DACA. He believes women are being raped at levels never heard
but
of.
But again, you wonder if he's hearing this on some of these far-fetched.
I think he does.
Or
yes.
Far-fetched conspiracy.
I listened to Fox and Friends this week, so I was doing a piece about the caravan, and there's I don't remember her name, a very attractive
blonde
woman, very blonde.
They're always a blonde,
and she said. She said, quote unquote, to within a few words, that the Democrats and the far left leaning mainstream press were cheering the immigrants on saying, let's open their borders and let them in. Did you guys miss that?
Yeah.
The cheering? Did you see that?
No. And you listened to Laura Ingraham, who's been in trouble. We're going to talk about her in a minute. I guess she's back next week. Or Sean Hannity. I mean, Sean Hannity made up that the young man was murdered
Seth
and the
Rich.
Family finally
oh, Seth
Rich. Sued. With some big Democrat plot or something that was, mm-hmm. it was just, the family finally said, why are you?
And now they're suing him.
Yeah, well.
Can we stay on Trump, though, just for one second? The other thing he did yesterday, if there was ever proof that any lawyer with a third of a brain who represents the president will never let him go in front of Bob Mueller, it was yesterday when, I think, an Associated Press reporter on the plane throws out the question, did you know about the $130,000 payment from Michael Cohen, your lawyer, I'm paraphrasing, to Stormy Daniels?
No,
I didn't. If you have any questions, talk to Michael Cohen. The significance of that, without getting lost in the weeds, giving people a headache, is this gives ammunition, as her lawyer was crowing about
last night,
to basically say, well, if he didn't have anything to do with the agreement, then obviously the agreement is null and void.
Yeah, because he doesn't know about it.
Exactly, because his contention, even though he's probably lying, is he didn't know about the thing. And the notion, I had Martha Coakley and Dan Small, both former U.S. attorneys, and both, well, obviously she was the attorney general too, and both worked with Bob Mueller. I said, would you ever allow Donald Trump, your client, to appear in front of Mueller? And before I finished the question, they both said no. Can you imagine him with this made up stuff in front of Mueller, even if he had.
That's what he would do.
Exactly, he would.
Yeah.
But you know, it is amazing every day how none of this matters.
Doesn't matter.
These stories about this EPA guy, Scott Pruitt, who's demanding first
class. Fantastic guy. He's fantastic.
Yeah, first class air flights. He's demanding bulletproof cars to drive around in an entourage of 20. He wanted to have many politicians gotten in trouble for this. Stuck in traffic and wanting to put on the blue lights so you can whiz through traffic.
Yeah,
and then,
but did you hear what happened there?
Yeah,
his
the
head
guy
of security said, I won't do it.
And then he got demoted.
He got demoted, exactly.
And then he gave massive raises to people. And
I don't know how that happened. I'm checking into that.
The level of corruption is unbelievable on the cabinet level, people. And it's amazing because Pruitt probably is the only one that isn't loaded. I mean, Betsy DeVos can take a private plane because she's a billionaire.
I was not that outraged about paying that $50 for the apartment.
Oh, you
know, you get
from
whatever
a lobbyist,
deal you can. For your,
no, not from a fossil fuel lobbyist. But
well,
you know what the interesting...
But he lied about it, though. He kept saying that it was because his second daughter was there in a second bed. Mm. Well, apparently she was only there for a very short amount of time. She wasn't there most of the time.
The lying isn't good.
The lying is
But the
not
most significant
a good thing.
Point is the point that you made, in my opinion, what? Marjorie, is that no one cares.
No one cares.
His
no
poll
cares.
Numbers are modestly creeping up. As arguably the walls are closed, the Mueller walls are closing more.
Well,
but
you
there
wonder,
appears to be no impact.
If how nervous the Republicans are getting about the market, stock market, which is
what's happening today.
Was down 400 points
yeah.
as
oh, really?
Of a few 20 minutes ago. I don't
yeah,
know.
Maybe
what
it's back up now, but it was not doing well on the tariff, the trade war speculation.
In any case, can we move on? Yesterday we talked about this photographer, longtime professor. Nixon. At MassArt, who obviously is famous for a lot of things, most famous for the Brown Sisters. 40-plus years he's taken photograph of four sisters,
yeah,
one
that's
of
a good,
whom
that's a
is
good
his
series.
Wife, and it's currently at the ICA. When we were discussing, Chelsea, Marjorie, and I were discussing yesterday morning whether or not we should do that with callers yesterday, I was against it, not because I didn't think it was an interesting story and an important story, but because I said
everybody's
going to agree with us and say... It's outrageous.
Yeah.
Every single caller, I think except one, Marjorie, disagreed with us
really?
And said, you don't understand crossing boundaries as you should.
Art.
In art, you are a prude. You are troubled by nudity.
No.
Every single person.
They're missing something here. He was having his students take off their clothes, and then he'd walk up to them and say, can I touch you? Can I kiss you? That has nothing to do with art.
Well, his own students, that's the key.
His students.
His own students. And four of the students... He asked them individually to come in in an office, take off their tops, and then he took photographs of them.
I mean, I took some kooky art classes in college, and I can remember one where nudity was encouraged. Let's put it that way.
What
I
do you
didn't
mean
do
nudity
it.
Was encouraged?
Oh, it
we
was this.
Sit in class
it was, we
nude?
Were doing something called art on TV, which was a fresh concept at the time. Anyway, it was. I didn't do it, but I remember those kinds of things came in to play. You know, because there's this kind of whole psychosexual, you know, arty, you know. I totally understand it. But this was prurience.
Yeah, I mean, but I read a lot more.
And the
guy analyzing,
you know, how people are having sex, or that girl who was bending over and then he takes the pointer and says, "There's her PU." You know, it's like, yeah. What?
Well, the other thing is, can I get back though to one thing you said, because I tried to make this point yesterday, is if students themselves, getting back to your art class in college, if students themselves decide to do this in a class, go for it. That's perfectly fine. The issue here is the relationship between the professor, a powerful professor,
I totally disagree with you. I think because we were in school a long time ago, you could get away with this stuff. I don't think there's anybody, any professor, who should be talking to young women in college about getting naked in any
class.
So what
do you disagree with? I'm saying if the students themselves decide as part of their project they want to do this without the mandate from the professor.
Well, that's, I don't want any encouragement from the professor.
I agree with you.
It was more than encouragement. It was more than encouragement.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just think it was an
insistence. This is what we're going to do. This is today's,
can I tell you two things
lesson plan
that also trouble me about this, and then we can leave it if you want. We mentioned yesterday on the air that in the Globe story that the school, Mass Art, which I think is a great place, and we interviewed the new president 18 months ago or something, David Nelson, said they refused to tell the Globe and in turn the public what their policy was on students being asked to pose nude for a professor. I thought that was troubling.
Why would you have a policy?
Well, your policy should be no. But
why would you have to put that into a policy? Here's
what's more troubling is, there are policies now at schools that professors can't have relationships, sexual relationships with students. But let me finish this. What Malcolm Gay, who was along with Kay Lazar, wrote the piece, was on my show last night. Two things. One thing he said on the air, one thing he said off the air. On the air, he said, MassArt refused to talk to him. Other than putting out a statement, they refused to talk to the reporter when something like this serious happens. And by the way, there's another Saul Levine, or Levine was the guy who showed the video.
Now the Globe knows how the rest of us feel because they don't talk about their problems.
Well, that's
either.
Number one. And number two, you know what he told me off the air? Because I asked him whether or not Marjorie said she wasn't going to go see the Brown sisters because of this.
Oh, yeah.
He called
it's ruined it for me.
He called the ICA, told me, and the ICA refused to return his call as well. I don't understand.
No, I don't understand that either. Globe doesn't return calls.
Other kind of thing. In any case, I think that the fact that the guy was forced into retirement is exactly
I
the
think
right
that was all right in this case.
Thing. And you usually don't like people being run out of town on
a
rail, but this guy.
I read the details on that.
Well, this is why I'm so encouraged by the Me Too movement, that this kind of pressure that you would feel from teachers when you're 18 or 19 years old, or the let's go out and discuss your work, and you end up not going out and discussing your work. It's something else that's going on there. I think that stuff is going to stop because they're worried about getting turned in, and they're worried about losing their jobs.
They should be worried.
They should. So
you know what changed to make your point as well, too, is the 25 students who were contacted by the Globe, not one of them had done a complaint, even though roughly half of them were troubled by the behavior, but they were all willing to talk to the Globe, and I think that's a function of different time.
The Me Too movement.
Exactly.
So I'm not surprised they didn't complain. You're in
nor am I.
Did you complain about the stuff that went on?
Of course not.
Absolutely not.
No.
Let's come look at my etchings. How many times did you hear that?
By the way,
the years?
Some people didn't like when I said this. This is no different from what Harvey Weinstein did with young actresses. I mean, obviously, rape is
I'd
worse.
It's very similar.
But it's exactly the same thing.
Your career.
You want to progress.
Well, it was
in
seduction. This guy was seducing these
guys. I agree. I totally agree.
But with the expectation, the other last thing, and then I'll shut up about this, one of the things that's so insidious about this, I think particularly for young women, because it's usually young women that are the receiving end, is that it so undermines your self-confidence. Am I a good photographer, or does he just want to go to bed with me? Am I a good writer, or does he just want to go to bed with me? And, it takes you a long time to figure out whether you're talented, whether you're smart, whether you have a gift, or whether
it's just... Have you figured it out yet?
I was quite old.
Didn't you have
it
didn't
out.
You have an editor in one of your jobs?
Oh, yeah.
You
told name his name?
With a naked photograph or a painting of a naked woman, right?
Oh, yeah, this is great. Yeah. I remember from my job interview. This is at the Herald. This is a long time. This is when Murdoch ran the Boston Herald. But I'm in for the interview with a guy, and the guy's got a big naked poster over his head.
Seriously?
And every time he moves his head, the bare breast, the nipple comes out on one side, then he moves his head back to the other side. Yeah. But you know something? I did say something to him, because I was by then about in my mid-30s, a little bit more daring. And I said, every time you move your head, I'm seeing a bare breast. Do we have to have this discussion?
Pretty bold.
He was so apologetic. Oh, you know, with the English accent. Oh, fine. Okay. I'm sorry. We'll go out in the hallway. And I get hired, and it was fun.
Out in the hallway?
Yeah, we went out in the hallway. Because
but he didn't take
room,
it down.
His room. No, are you kidding?
You remember when they
are you kidding?
When they put a drape over the bare breast of the Department of Justice Ashcroft was the Attorney General?
Yeah.
Because usually the bare breast was right over his shoulder in the press conferences. In any case, we're talking Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press.
Yeah, okay. So Emily Rooney, we talked about Laura Ingraham before. She's coming back. She took a week off. She said it was a planned vacation week. I'm suspicious about that. But after advertisers began to withdraw from her show in great numbers, after she ridiculed David Hogg. It's Hogg,
Hogg,
right?
Yeah, Hogg.
One of the Parkland shooting survivors when she said he whined about not getting into four colleges. By the way,
what did he say?
How do you have a 4.1 GPA?
Well, because it's UCLA, among other places. I mean, everybody in California has a 4.1.
Oh, I thought 4.0 was a perfect
record. Yeah, I don't know
record.
How you had 4.1.
I don't know either.
Well, what's your question?
But anyway, the advertisers withdrew because he started this, you know, boycott the advertisers thing. She's coming back on Monday. What's the latest on Laura Ingraham?
Well, I mean, Fox hasn't said she's not coming back, so I'm assuming she will. She did not address this on her television show. You realize this.
Mm-hmm.
She only addressed it through a tweet. The only announcement she made was that she was going on vacation, which was a week ago Friday. So now I will be interested to see if she actually addresses it on television.
Wait a second. She didn't say things like an apology, and I was the first person to have David on the air. Oh, that was a tweet. Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, she did it all through Twitter, and that's how she apologized, too, through Twitter. And that was what he rejected, the apology. She said, in the spirit of Holy Week, I would like to apologize to David Hogg and the other brave students who survived the shooting at Parkland. And he just said, I'm not accepting it. I mean, there has been some pushback against him, too, but he's a 17-year-old kid. I mean, this editorial in the Herald today, this nutty editorial is like equating him Larry Elder with all these other people that have done horrendous things. No, who's the bully? Suggesting that somehow David Hogg is the bully because he organized this boycott. By the way, I've said this many times and I'll repeat myself. I'm not a big fan of these boycotts. And I've said this about O'Reilly. I said it about Hannity. I said it about Laura Ingraham. If what the people did is that egregious, the bosses, the managers should be taking these people aside and saying, you know what, that's over the line, as they've done with at WEI and a couple of other places like that, before it gets to this. I mean, somebody should have said, Laura, you know.
Are you kidding me?
Are you kidding me?
They are all about the bottom line there.
I know, but they should project in this day and age that it's going to be the bottom line. If they would look like heroes, if before the advertisers started to bail, they started addressing some of these things. They're going to have to be more proactive.
Well, listen, how much did Fox News pay out in millions and millions of dollars?
They completely
Bill O'Reilly before they got rid of him?
They blew that because they only fired him because the advertisers bailed. If they had dealt with it and put him on probation or suspended him for 4 months, they'd still have Bill O'Reilly, and the advertisers would not have Bill.
You used to
That's
be his boss.
Saying.
Why don't you fix him up, correct him in those days?
Yeah.
You know, one last thing in the spirit of transparency to show we have no idea what we're talking about occasionally. You and I both said, a la Bill O'Reilly, this vacation is going to be one from which Laura Ingraham never returns.
Oh,
and
I don't
apparently,
know.
I
She's
said
returning.
It, and she apparently is going back
just,
on the air Monday.
I just her constant invocation of Holy Week. And
that is
constant
nauseating.
Wearing of crosses around her neck. Is
I can't
really
stand that. Because it is the literal holier than thou. I'm much more spiritual. I'm much more connected with the earth and God because I'm wearing this cross around my neck.
Yeah.
You know, by the way, Tori, I think, just typed on our screen, you can have a 4.1 GPA if you take certain honors or AP classes, advanced placement classes that are weighted more heavily than regular ones,
wow.
Marjorie.
All
so
right.
That's the answer to your question.
There you go.
Okay, so here we go. The reason Emily makes her appearance every single Friday.
That's not the only.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
It doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
It doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Oh, that's too bad. So what are we doing here?
Well, we've got something you're all going to want to pitch in on.
Oh, I love that.
This is called Tax Day Anxiety.
Oh! Ooh.
Okay?
Okay.
All right. First of all, I've never been audited, but I dread it and fear it, and like I think about it, you know, at least 4 or 5 times a year, you think, I wonder. And then I don't even keep stuff anymore. I don't know about you, but you know, I feel my tax guy has that. You know?
Every receipt I keep. I was audited twice, and
you
let me
have
tell
been?
You, and I've had no change, which means they confirmed that we did. It is the most terrifying. By the way, the people were very nice. You feel like you're at an inquisition, even though they treat you respectfully. It was two of the scariest days of my life.
Twice, and both times the government ended up paying him more than $200,000.
Oh, that is fabulous.
Isn't that great?
Wow.
Well, I didn't get a check, but I didn't have to pay more either.
All right, here's another one. I've never filed for an extension because somehow I feel it's going to trigger an audit or make me look like I'm hiding something.
I've never filed on time, so I'm at the other end of the
spectrum.
I knew
that. How did
always
I just do it? You always get an extension? Have
always
you ever
get an extension.
I've gotten several extensions.
File in October
I just don't
every
have my
year.
Stuff,
no, I start
my
pulling my
together.
Stuff. I have to do it. I get manic about
Can
it.
Can we give a little information, though? By the way, for people who think you file for an extension so you don't have to pay, if you owe money
you pay
and
an
you
interest.
Don't pay exactly
you pay an interest.
On April 15th or whatever date it is, you pay interest.
But do you pay an estimated anyway?
I do. As the year goes along, I do.
All right. No, I mean, but on assuming that you're going to owe for 2017, do you like write a check and then file?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, okay.
I do, yeah.
All right. I do a little of that. All right. So I prepare myself to pay a dizzying amount of taxes. Like, I mean, like I load my checking account with, you know, tons of money just in case. And then that's so I won't faint when I get the bill.
Yeah.
So I'm just prepared.
That's good.
Actually, this year was a little lower than I thought. So
I'm very glad.
Good.
You know that you can raise your withholding. You know that? You don't have to go through that pain?
This is not about that.
What is it about?
I already pay every time I make from. You don't want to
know.
Okay,
fine.
Emily's making more money than us. That's what she's basically saying.
Oh, no. All right. I used to ignore paying those quarterly taxes, even though you're supposed to, because I was thinking, how is it possible that I could actually owe more than I already pay? So, this year I won't owe. I didn't even worry about the penalty. But now I'm getting out my checkbook.
What quarterly taxes?
I knew you were going to get nervous about this. If you either have income that from which there is not withholding.
Yeah.
Oh.
Or, so it's not taxed at the time.
Oh.
Or you think
capital
you don't
gains.
Have enough withholding from your paycheck. Every 3 months, people submit a check for estimated
taxes. So I started doing that. But just last year.
Didn't work?
It did. It was helpful. Just helpful. Didn't really do
it. Yeah, if you freelance,
really
you get hammered.
By the way, Marjorie's anxiety at the end of this list is going to be so totally
all right,
out of control.
No, seriously.
Good.
When they send me my packet, you know, the guys who do this, this one is just a tad more than a half an inch thick. And I'm thinking, what do Mitt Romney's taxes look like? What do
Donald Trump's.
If mine are that thick? And is this really... Is it really necessary that they be so complicated?
Yeah.
Because the next thing on my list is that I feel like I should be able to do my own. And basically, I cannot. I cannot do it.
Yeah, I think if you're young, you can do it. My kids all do the TurboTax thing.
Yeah, but my daughter does that too.
Yeah.
But as soon as you get into anything more complicated than a straightforward salary.
You have to hire a person.
So I was
or even if you just have a straightforward salary, you may have to hire a person. I think a lot of people are intimidated by doing their taxes.
So I don't know what this means. So I'm actually going through the thing, and there's all these forms I really don't understand. And then I come across this one, foreign tax credit.
Mm.
What is that?
I took a lot of those this year.
For what is it for?
I had no idea. I just took them. No, it's
what
a joke.
Is it?
That's a joke. That's
do you know what it is?
Do you cheat on your taxes?
God, I hope not.
Okay, fine.
You know, remember when didn't Trump bring in wheelbarrows full of his taxes when he were talking about
remember.
His tax return?
I think that was Trump's stakes that he brought in.
Yeah, and he had all the piles of papers.
Okay, next.
Okay, Jim.
Yeah.
Do you understand the alternative minimum tax?
Actually, I do.
I knew it. I don't understand it, but I'm hurt by it.
He's the tax man.
I actually do.
Okay, what is the alternative minimum tax?
The alternative minimum tax was created a few decades ago.
Not that long ago.
A couple of decades ago. Only to capture something like the 400 wealthiest people in the country who, because of deductions, were paying nothing in federal taxes. And the notion was they should pay something, even if they legally are reducing their taxes to nothing. Because there's not an inflation adjustment, it now covers tens of millions of Americans who, instead of paying the tax that is mostly upper income, it is upper income Americans, it raises the taxes because we use so many deductions that we reduce our taxes to an unreasonable amount. And Donald Trump and the Republicans...
They took it away.
...wanted to take it. No, they took a piece of it away, but most of it is still there.
I thought it was people that are in the high upper middle
it
class.
It is high, yes.
That make $150,000 or something like
it's
that.
Way, it's way... No, it's, I don't know if it's that low.
That's right.
No, I mean, it's...
It's not just about salary. I mean, you can't take certain deductions anymore. I mean...
It knocks out, like, yeah. a lot of your itemized deductions.
Yeah. Well, right. One of the things that get knocked out in the tax plan is your interest on your home equity loans.
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with the alternative.
No, it doesn't. Well, it's very upsetting because...
If you have, like, a Cape house or something like that, it does, because you can't take all those taxes, too.
Yeah, or the if you financed your children's college education on home equity
loans.
I
have always said that should be tax deductible.
Well,
college
it's not.
Education.
I agree
it's
with
not.
You.
It's
okay,
not.
Next.
Always.
What's next?
All right, well, I only have one more.
What is it?
Electronic filing is the best thing since email.
I couldn't agree more. One of the greatest things of all time.
It's so great. You just sign the
Marjorie's
thing.
Marjorie's anxious about that, too.
No, I have someone do my taxes.
You do?
No,
do
I've almost got everything figured out. Do I e-file?
Yeah, or do you send the whole packet to the IRS?
The guy who does your taxes, his nickname is Shifty. So I don't know if that's a problem. If it's
have you guys finished yours yet?
No,
I don't do it till October. I told you, I get an extension every single year.
I'm doing mine in April, but I haven't finished.
Okay, fine.
Next week,
I think I'm
going to
get money back, though. I'm excited about that.
That was an excellent anxiety-producing list.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, good. So what are you doing tonight on that piece of press show?
Well, we are going to take a look at the derivation of the whole caravan thing and how it got straightened out. Sinclair Broadcasting, which the owner of Sinclair made every anchor. I think he owns 56 television stations.
193.
Do you know, if
read
you get
the same editorial about fake news. And he's a big Trump supporter, and he'd forced the stations to carry these pro-Trump editorials in the fall or right before the election.
You know something? If I'm correct, what I read this morning about how if the regulations that loosen up these broadcasting monopolies go through, they'll be in seven of every 10.
Yeah, that's right.
It is currently the largest broadcast.
Yeah, seven of every 10.
If your job
homes.
Depended on it, could you have read that editorial?
I said to Marjorie the other day on the air, I would like to think that I would be principal enough to buck management, but if you're
you're a single mother with
money,
two or three children, it's awfully hard to quit your job without something else to go to. I mean, I think it would be wonderful to take the honorable position, but I think a lot of people just feel like, how am I going to pay the mortgage?
What's very disturbing about this is that the owner, what's his name again? It begins with an E, F from Moon.
I can't think of it.
So if he had done the editorial, if he had been the voice of it, Bill Fine at Channel 5. Fine, but to force your anchors to basically read an editorial is not right.
Can I tell you one of the most impressive things editorially that was ever done? Was it Deadspin? Who did the thing?
Deadspin.
With Deadspin. Where they had all the voices speaking simultaneously.
Yeah, I'm using a clip of that.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Totally brilliant.
All right.
That's it. We'll see you tonight at 7. Thank you so much, Emily. Good luck with your taxes.
Have you finished your taxes yet?
Yeah.
Oh, you have. Okay, very good.
Obsessive.
Okay, that's good. I'm not
done
yet.
I'm not filing for an extension.
I have a lot more to do. I'm very upset. It's going to ruin my whole weekend. Emily Rooney joins us every Friday. Of course, you can keep up with her right here on WGBH Channel 2 Friday nights on Beat the Press. It's a special taping. Is it a special taping today?
No, it's not.
Oh, no, it's not. Okay, forget that.
May 11th, she'll be back at the library.
No special taping. But you can see her on TV at 7 o'clock on WGBH Channel 2. Up next, Boston Globe columnist Shirley Young is here, listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Is the Wynn Casino in Everett about to not just lose its name, but its license as well? Here with us for a take on this and other things in the business world is Boston Globe business columnist and GBH contributor Shirley Young. Hello there, Shirley.
Hi.
Hello, Shirley Young. Well, before we get to anything else,
of course,
Jim has insisted upon a bird update, please. There is a big story about how, you know, birds are crashing into buildings like the John Hancock Tower with big glass sides, and there are millions and millions, if not more, birds that lose their lives every year. And we want to know.
A billion,
yes.
Why do we never see these poor little dead birds on the sidewalk as we walk to work?
So last week, I was in touch with developers, but I didn't have time to talk to the Mass Audubon Society, which is, this is one of their, they've written letters to the city and to, about this issue. And so I got a little update because.
Excellent.
With, so many birds, hitting skyscrapers, we wondered why don't we see birds' carcasses on the ground? Why aren't we having birds fall on our head? And I was told that the birds that we're talking about, they're quite tiny. They're like the size of your thumb. And so, and often they hit the buildings at night. And so they're small. And also, were you the one that raised this? What if maybe predators eat
them. Can them, yes.
Yes, that is true.
That's
so
what happens.
So rats, you know, rats eat them, and so we might not see them because they get eaten, or they're caught up on terraces, and so they do happen. We just don't see them.
Okay,
so
can I respond to this? This is the worst job of reporting in the history
of... What kind of birds are those?
Wait a second.
We have sparrows.
If a penny falls on your head from 30 stories up, it's going to...
Well, it could be a combination happening at night. But no, but I guess...
But there's not one person we know about who's been hit by a falling bird out of a billion. How is that possible?
Maybe their wings come out like in rigor mortis style fashion and slow them down like a little parachute on the way down. But I've never seen little teeny tiny birds around
here.
I
haven't either.
And at my sister's house, I see the birds hit the windows. If you have the big windows, you know?
Yeah.
And they're pretty... Good size
Sure,
bird,
you know what that is?
What?
Fake news. Let me
fake
just tell
news.
You. Go back to the drawing board.
Okay.
Next week
no
you can
Pulitzer.
Try again.
No Pulitzer on that.
That is pathetic. I mean, that was just an attempt to get it behind you. I mean, really.
It was really an attempt to get it. I am tired of talking about the birds. I love that story, but not
so
anymore.
Okay. We're talking
all
to
right.
Shirley Young
the
from the Boston Globe.
Jim, why don't you go out and do some reporting? How about that?
Well, that's
you
why we have guests in here, isn't it, Marjorie? So Shirley,
she doesn't like to make any phone calls. You
as
know what I
you
mean?
Know, I don't. I like people to come to me. That is correct. Shirley, I am casino obsessed, as I
yes.
think you know. And while yes. you wrote about the Mashpee Wampanoags and whether they're going to finally get their federal whatever they need to be able to build something in Southeast, I want to get back to that in a second. I'm obsessed with the Wynn thing.
Yeah.
The conventional wisdom, correct me if I'm wrong, if after we heard the stories about Steve Wynn a month or so ago, the feeling, at least my feeling, and you'll tell me if you feel otherwise, that at minimum the Gaming Commission was going to say the name has got to come off the building, you got to rename it something else, Wynn can't be on the building. But after this Wall Street Journal article a couple of days ago saying essentially it wasn't just Wynn who did this stuff and it wasn't just some members of the board who knew about it, but I think they used the word enablers, the pressure is on the Gaming Commission to declare that they are under the statute not suitable license holder. So is it possible that Wynn, after all they've spent, after all the construction, which continues to go on, might lose the whole damn license?
I mean, I think when this story first broke, I don't know if it's over a month ago now, I was thinking to myself, oh, I don't think they'll lose a license. I think they'll, you know, the Gaming Commission will, of course, have to conduct their own investigation about what was known when by the board in terms of Steve Wynn and sexual harassment allegations. And but now, as this story, it seems like every week there's another shoe drops on it, and I think this last story was very damaging.
Wall Street Journal,
that there was a cover up, and so I think the Gaming Commission has said that the Wynn Resorts builds this casino at risk. You know, they actually could get their license.
Steve Crosby built. Used those words.
Yeah,
the chair of the
risk.
Gaming Commission says you're proceeding at your own risk.
At your own risk. And so, you know, and now what's happening, and, you know, there are a lot of rumors out there and stories. You know, there was Everett Leader was reporting today. I don't know how.
That's a newspaper in Everett?
Yeah, and okay. I don't know how. There was only an unnamed source saying that maybe Sheldon Adelson, Dorchester native, big casino magnate in
Vegas.
One of
the richest people in America.
America may, you know, maybe he'll buy the Everett Casino. There was also a report in the New York Post that MGM Resorts may buy all of Wynn Resorts. You know,
but if that happened, whether it's Adelson or MGM, all of that would need to be approved, and they'd need to be found, quote, suitable themselves by the Gaming Commission.
Right, and
right?
So very interesting. Yes, basically, as if Adelson is applying for a license,
right.
He would have to go through vetting. Also, I also wondered, could, you know, MGM is building a resort in Springfield. I don't think MGM could hold two licenses in Massachusetts. And so I think that would be, so even if MGM bought Wynn Resorts, they couldn't operate two casinos here in Massachusetts.
You know what I found interesting about the Adelson rumor, beyond the fact that he's from here, I think he lives in Las Vegas. I think he lives in Las Vegas now, but he's a Dorchester kid and he's loaded and obviously.
And he might have a home here still.
I remember the following like it was yesterday, which is because I asked Steve Crosby about this repeatedly. The best idea, I was anti-casino. I think everybody, I haven't been
everybody
quiet
knows
about
that, Jim.
But no, but Charlie Baker famously. As candidate had the best idea in my estimation, mm-hmm. is build one casino, build it in Springfield, see if it works. if it helps boost the economy, creates jobs, is not a crime problem, then we can go from there. But the reason I thought of that is because I would always ask Crosby, the chair of the commission, who's very good about coming in and answering questions, is Shelley Adelson, who knows as much about casinos as anybody, chose not to bid for a casino when the statute said there could be as many as three because he said it was too much for the market.
Yeah.
So what I find interesting, if this Everett Leader report is right, if it's right, if he's bidding for what would be, well, the second casino with the possibility of a third, either Mashpee, Wampanoag, or something in the southeast, maybe that's because he thinks the market is much more favorable to gaming here than a lot of us thought. You know, there's obviously, there was one slot parlor. There's Springfield, definitely. There'll be something in Everett.
And there's Tiverton
in
Rhode Island, too.
And, but I mean in this, well, right, and Connecticut has its two things
it's
as
not
well.
Not very far from here at all.
So the Adelson thing would be a huge development.
You know what I wonder, though? I mean, I was obsessed with the Wynn casinos. So I saw the pictures online of the floating furniture that, that the casinos were out in Las Vegas, and they looked just so spectacular and snazzy, and not the tacky way you kind of think that they would look. But in terms of Everett and the jobs and the money and all that, it, unless it's delayed, it wouldn't really matter to Everett, would it?
I mean, right now, no one's talking about stopping construction.
Right.
I mean, they're still building it. And I you know, and so there's they're not at a point there where anyone's talking about halting construction. I mean, I assume that they will. They're far along. I mean, they're supposed to open next year. I think they would just go ahead and finish it, and unless it, and then deal with, or at least get as far as they can, and then deal with if they have to, you know, sell it to someone else or give up their license. But we're not there yet.
You know, again, well, I was against. I respect the will of the voters. They said they want casinos. Then we should have casinos. I think it's naive on all of our parts to think, and maybe I'm wrong, is if this would be huge. If they take the license away from Wynn, it seems that there's got to be some dislocation, even if there's an attempt to sell what they've already done. I can't imagine a circumstance in which there's not some delay.
Right, there probably would be delay.
And they were talking about 2019 there.
You have to vet the new owner.
And right, and if Wynn's license is taken away while they're vetting the new owner, the Gaming Commission, Wynn's not going to keep building based upon the hope that whoever gets the license is going to give them dollar for dollar for every dollar they've put out of pocket. So the impact, the potential impact is huge. But the flip side is, I have to say, I don't understand how the Gaming Commission does not find them unsuitable, to use a double negative, if the Wall Street Journal story is true.
I mean, they're doing their own investigation, but you have to think that the Gaming Commission has to be on... be on very solid ground to take the license away, because
when will we sue, right?
Exactly.
By the way, that's another thing which I hadn't thought of, which is obvious. What you said is, if they take away the license, not only is there a time lag while they're approving a new owner, Wynn is going to try to get a stay from the court saying that we have a reasonable case to think that it was taken away unfairly.
Right.
And even if they don't get a stay, is the new licensed bidder going to be willing to do what he or she has to do, knowing that Wynn might ultimately win their lawsuit?
Right.
So the potential for delay is immense, I think.
I
agree.
In any case,
we're talking to Shirley Young from the Boston Globe. And in southeastern Mass, the Mashpee Wampanoags are still...
Well, so the latest thing is that they, it's been 2 years since they broke ground. And the latest with them is that now there's been a lawsuit that stopped them in their tracks, questioning whether or not they had sovereign rights to their land. And they need sovereign rights to their land in order to build a casino. And now it's up to the Department of Interior to make a ruling. And they've been waiting for 2 years now. And they're tired of waiting. And they think they might get an unfavorable ruling. So that's why now they're going the congressional route, which would ensure them sovereign rights. No lawsuit would ever threaten their ability to build a casino there. What's interesting to me is that I was looking through this, the Pequots in Connecticut. I mean, they were one of the first tribes to have an Indian gaming casino, and they also they ended up going the congressional route as well.
I didn't know that.
And so one of the things that was interesting about checking in with the Wampanoags is that I learned that, you know, why was it so easy for the Connecticut tribes to, it was also Mohegan Sun, to build a casino? And back then, people didn't think Indian gaming would succeed. So they're like, go ahead, let's let the tribes do the casinos. And then they realized, wow, they're wildly successful. So now everybody wants a piece of the action. And so they, across the country, tribes are facing legal challenges to stop these casinos. And I actually, the thinking is that Wampanoags will probably eventually prevail legally, you know, through the courts. But it would take, you know, they've been doing this for 10 years. It could take another decade. But the congressional route is a faster and cleaner way.
And correct me if I'm wrong. The reason one of the reasons the Gaming Commission cited when they decided not to award a casino to, was it Taunton? I think Taunton.
Brockton Casino.
Was because they worried that there'd be one, 17 miles away,
There would be competition from the Native American thing. Yeah.
And for those who don't understand all this stuff, unlike a regular commercial casino, which does need state approval, if a Native American tribe gets whatever federal stamp of approval, they don't need state approval. No. They can just open up a casino. We're talking to Shirley Young.
Our staff just posted on the screen a bit of breaking news, which is significant in terms of gun battles, that the federal judge has just dismissed a lawsuit challenging Massachusetts' ban on assault weapons and okayed Moore Healey's enforcement notice to gun sellers and manufacturers, clarifying what constitutes a copy or duplicate weapon.
Yeah.
So that's a big win for gun rights in Massachusetts and for the Attorney General, actually.
Well, for gun control rights in Massachusetts.
Right.
Yeah, it is. Thanks for that. So can we move to the transportation front, one of Marjorie's favorite topics there?
Yeah, well, let's start with the MBTA. And it turns out that the reason that a lot of bus trips were not on time this year and buses didn't show up when they should have was because people were taking off family medical leave act time in small chunks. So I guess basically some of the bus drivers were increasing their vacation time by 12 weeks, although you don't get paid for family leave time, so they were willing to take it with the time off.
You know, this story by my colleague Adam Vicar, what was striking about it was that the rate that the MBTA had to cancel their buses, it was very similar to the winter of 2015.
Right.
And that was very surprising. And the T is now trying to hire more drivers, but it boggles the mind because I was thinking, doesn't everybody want to work for the T? I mean, it's right, good benefits, and you know, you get to drive a bus. It sounds like a fun job, you know. And yet, you know, they're struggling to, you know, find enough people or fill these positions, and they're having to cancel. Mm-hmm. I think on average about 360 trips a day.
Yeah.
So it's pretty surprising. And so I mean, but good for the T to kind of recognize that they have this problem, try to get ahead of it.
Well, with one caveat though that I didn't quite understand from having read the story, they say that the Baker administration, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, was able to reduce the percentage of cancellations to, 1.18% a year or so ago, and now it's up to almost more than double that.
Right.
What's happened?
I don't know.
Has
I mean,
caused the,
yeah, no, that's a really good question.
Lose
so,
control of that issue.
So,
well, it also talks about that a lot of these are part-time drivers. So maybe if you're a part-time driver, you don't get the sick days, the paid sick days that other people do. But this seems to me sort of an abuse of the idea of what the Family Medical Leave Act was supposed to be about, because it was about a family member that was sick.
Right.
So you could spend time taking care of your family member without pay, unfortunately, which means it's awful hard to do if you don't have a big salary. But this seems to me sort of an abuse of it when you're taking it here and there.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I mean, the thing is, like, I don't understand if they're paid or unpaid. I mean, it would make it sound like they are paid if they're taking time off, right?
Well, maybe there's a provision in their contract that we're
maybe
not
there is.
Aware
well,
of.
Because otherwise you wouldn't otherwise you wouldn't take the time off if it was unpaid.
Yeah.
So, the union was you know coming back and said, listen, the reason why absenteeism is high is because managers are encouraging drivers to not just take one day but multiple days off, and so, that's got to stop, and so it looks like they are trying to get ahead of this.
Well, here's another one that is, I guess we're going after the state police again here, but I did not even realize this, that this ramp that was in the Ted Williams Tunnel designed for these buses, the Silver Line buses, has been taken over by the state police. The Globe editorialized it and said that this should not be happening because of the terrible traffic problems we're talking about over incessantly, and they claim it's a security issue. I'm not really clear right. what the security issue is.
Transportation advocates have long talked about this, the barracks, you know, Troop, is it Troop E,
Troop
right,
B.
taking over the Silver Line ramp, and so, and it's supposed to shave quite a, you know, save quite a bit of time if Silver Line buses were able to.
In the Ted Williams Tunnel.
And they don't even want it exclusively. They said if they were able to just share it, it would save a lot of time. So I hope that gets done. I don't think that was in Governor Baker's press release.
I was actually looking for it this
not,
morning.
It was not in the press release about what to do with the Silver Line ramp, but you're starting to see, I mean, the transportation advocates have been actually writing about this ramp and to kind of take back the ramp because the Silver Line is seen as, you know, an important way to deal with the congestion issues in the Seaport District.
So the idea of this was this so that the state troopers could go through, use the ramp themselves to drive through the tunnel?
I think so. So they have fat, because remember there is, I think there's a, isn't there
I'm
a
you, Marjorie.
Police headquarters? There is some kind of police barracks, I think, right by the Pike, and so I think they have exclusive use of
oh,
it.
Oh, it's not just the barracks; it's Dunkin' Donuts. So no, that's a joke. Don't give me a ticket. But can I tell you one thing about this? Every time we talk about transportation problems, we say the reason they can't get fixed is because Charlie Baker ran as a no-tax governor. It needs new revenue. Virtually everybody knows that, except for, well, at least the governor and Stephanie Pollack, Secretary of Transportation. This is free. This wouldn't
right.
cost a penny.
This is political.
No,
this
it's
is political,
all about politics.
Yes.
And let me tell you,
it
when
means
Bill
standing
Evans,
up to the state
when
price.
Bill Evans had the courage on our show, the commissioner, to yeah. say maybe a month ago or mm-hmm. 2 months ago that the reason the whole, this is not this Seaport issue, it's the overlapping jurisdiction issue, was not resolved in the Seaport. Remember the word he used? He said the legislature did not
afraid.
Have the courage
right.
to confront this issue.
Well,
and
you know
I
what
think
else
it's
too?
Pretty clear.
From a taxpayer perspective, it's not big money, but still, the way it is
this is
now,
no money.
No, I know this is no
well,
money,
well,
but in terms of the Seaport,
right.
you
oh.
have both the state police and the Boston police.
And Massport.
And Massport,
part
and Massport
yeah.
responding to 911 calls down
right.
there. That is not a wise use of the taxpayer right. dollar right. here.
Now, Governor Baker did
I
mention
know,
in
yes,
the press
he
about,
yes, he
about straightening out the jurisdiction issues between Boston police and state police in the Seaport District. So I mean, if there was any time to get the Silver Line, for the Silver Line to take back its ramp, I think it's actually named, I think it's called the Silver Line Way or something like that. This is the time to do it. So we'll see. If it finds a champion.
And the solution, for those who are concerned, if Amazon moves its second headquarters here, how are they going to get around? They just sleep at work. I mean, that's the because clearly they're never going to be able to get to work or get home, so you just stay there.
But, you know, it really, I mean, it's like a broken record on this whole thing. It is amazing how much I've noticed, and I've lived here for a long time, the traffic just exploding the last few years.
Well, it's the Dante
crazy.
Ramos piece in the Boston Globe
yeah.
the other
yeah,
day.
Yeah, it's the growth. It's Uber. It's Lyft. It's the fact that no one depends on the T anymore,
yep.
that no one depends on the buses
not
anymore.
No one, but
well, you
not
can't
enough.
Depend on them to
yeah.
get you where you're expecting to go on time. That's the issue.
Snowing,
you
by
take
the way.
Them. It's snowing.
It is
that's
April
good.
That's what the,
for,
that's what the
oh,
forecaster said.
Sorry,
it
I didn't
would
mean
snow.
To interrupt
yeah,
you.
Yeah, the Green Line will be out of service soon. Okay. What else we got here with Shirley Young? Oh, we've got this dorm delivery thing. This is pretty cool. Tell us about what's going on with Grubhub and BU.
Right. So Janelle Nanos wrote a story. She writes about restaurants and food. And it was really a story about how universities are trying to cater to this generation of, I guess, students. And, you know, for a long time, a lot of the universities have really you know, stepped it up on dorm food, right? Very gourmet meals or quinoa,
oh, yeah.
very healthy.
One
and
of the
now,
colleges are so expensive.
You know, the next frontier is delivering food to your dorm.
To a room,
to
not
your
to your dormitory,
right, right.
to your dorm room.
Like you can order your food on your app and then have your food delivered to you. And the reason why that, you know, this generation is all about convenience. So, I mean, I remember I only got pizza delivered, right?
Yeah, you just go to Dunkin' Donuts or
right.
pizza.
And also the food wasn't that great. I mean, today it's gourmet meals, and part of it is it's a profit center for universities. I mean, it's you can charge quite a bit, but the universities are stepping up and doing convenience. They're even doing, I think, UMass Amherst, they're even doing like Blue Apron style meal kits for students who live off campus, because this is a profit center. So they're trying to keep up with the habits of students, and they don't want to lose them. And I was when I was reading Janelle's story, I was thinking, yeah, I remember, because when I was at Princeton, we were on a meal plan, freshman year, sophomore year, and then junior and senior year, you go to an eating club. Yeah. And I did 6 months of my junior year, and then after that, I was off a meal plan to save money, and also I didn't have time to trek all the way down to the eating club on the other side of campus. So, I saved my parents $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, and this was like 20 years ago.
What did you eat?
No, we cooked. Well,
oh, you cooked.
I worked at the student newspaper, so we were always eating sandwiches. Right. We were eating like ramen noodles in the student newspaper. Yeah. We were always there on deadline. So.
If they had delivered food to dorm rooms when I was in college, I would not have made it to one class in 4 years. It's the only reason I ever left my room was to go eat, and while I was out, I figured I'd go to class.
The one thing that worried me about this trend about delivering food to your dorm is that you don't get to hang out with all the students. You don't need to meet all these great minds, and you don't get to meet all different people on campus.
Yeah, but on the plus side, it doesn't interrupt your consumption of porn, and I think that's. For college kids, they just want to focus, and you know what I mean? And so it's so Shirley, you have one more week to get this bird thing right.
We're going to talk about birds again?
No, we're not accepting this pathetic excuse for an explanation today.
Make some phone calls. Get on top of things.
Let's talk over the weekend. I can collaborate.
Yeah, we did last week. He says to me, Margie, call the state police about something and find out about this whole thing.
I did say that.
And I said, I don't have time to them. I was writing something.
I said, email them. That's fine.
Yeah. I said, here's his number. You call him. Did you call him, Jim?
I had one of our coworkers call him, actually.
I asked him. Talk about birds again?
One more time. Just one more time. Yes.
Don't do it. I would
next
say,
week, Shirley will say, solve yeah. the bird riddle. Nice to see you, Shirley
Good
Young.
To see you.
Okay,
Thanks
thank you very
me.
Much, Shirley Young. Wonderful to talk to you, as always. Glad your arm is better there. Shirley Young is in the business columnist for the Boston Globe and WGBH contributor. She joins us every week. Thank you, Shirley. Up next, Amy Traverso from Yankee Magazine and WGBH's Weekends with Yankee is here to preview season 2 of their great weekend getaway TV show. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's April, theoretically. We're entering the third week of spring.
Yep.
And the high for today is 43.
That's right.
The low is the mid-30s. What's it doing outside, Marjorie?
Snowing.
That's New England weather. But yep. If you need to be reminded, it's not all rain and snow and freezing temperatures. Tune in to Weekends with Yankee. Season 2 premieres this Sunday on GBH2 at 12:30. It's full of sunshine, surfing, and the search for the perfect lobster roll, which we're going to talk about. Joining us for a preview is Amy Traverso, who, along with Richard Weiss, hosts the show. She's also the senior food editor at Yankee Magazine. Amy, it's great to see you again. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Good to see you.
So tell us about Weekends with Yankee Season 2. I watched some of the clips from it last night. It makes you so inspired. Think about a place that I haven't seen in New England. I've lived here all my life.
Well, we mostly only film in summer and fall.
Yeah.
So I need to see the show just to remember why I live here.
Because it's getting
a little hard. So season 2, we're going to some of the places that were on our bucket list.
Mm-hmm.
For me, what big one was going to this restaurant called The Lost Kitchen.
Have you heard about this?
Yes,
mm-hmm. We have heard about this. This is a place where you have to make 10,000 people reservations. There's 40 people sitting. Well, you tell us about it. That's why she's here, actually. Yeah, that's why she's here.
Actually, if you leave, we can just talk about it.
Yeah, you guys just take it right from here. I just cued it, and now you guys. So Erin French is the chef, and she opened this restaurant in a centrally isolated location in Maine. It's sort of 30 minutes inland from Bangor, an hour from Camden. And she had a following already. She had a restaurant in Belfast. So people started to hear about it, started to hear it's beautiful, started to hear the food's great, started to hear, like, everything sourced locally, and all the servers are farmers, and oh, my God. And it just became this cult restaurant, so that last year when they opened the reservation lines at midnight on April 1st, they had so many phone calls coming in, 10,000 over 24 hours, that actually the alarms went off at the fire station because they couldn't get any. The whole system was overwhelmed.
Oh, my gosh.
So they sold out their first season, the entire season through December, in about 24 hours. And now they're doing a thing where this year they're going to be taking reservations by postcard. In fact, if you want to do it, go to their website, because it's like this week.
You only have four more days.
Yeah, you only have four more days. Yeah, you got to get in.
And when I saw the little clip from your visit up there, it looked like she was toasting everybody that was in the restaurant, so they were kind of eating all at the same time?
Yes, so it's basically one seating a night. And she knows what everybody went through to get there. I mean, for me, I had to get on a TV show to get in because there was no way I was going to get a reservation. So luckily, they let us come up and see what it's all about. It's really beautiful.
How's the food?
It's very good. So she says she's a girl who cooks rather than a chef. It's not like high-concept food. It's just perfectly executed, gorgeous, like perfect ingredients. There's that style of like let the ingredients shine rather than like twirl it up too much.
You know, I was worried when I read that you were going there before I watched the clip. I assume going there meant like being outside, because I'm saying, why does she need to talk to anybody when in one day a year she books the whole season? Why did she talk to you?
It's a good question. I mean, I think they realize probably that when you have big spikes, you can have big dips. And maybe if it's a fad restaurant, people might. So I think they really want people to see, no, this isn't just
about.
That's
great. I'm dying to see it.
It's a really cool experience. It's well worth doing.
Before we move off, so what'd you eat up there that was perfectly executed?
So I had some incredible, she did these, there's a bit of theater. So there's a kind of big stove where she does most of the work. And so she's got like 40 lamb chops, like double thick lamb chops, going in multiple skillets at one time. And she's kind of juggling them and moving them in and out of the oven. And the lamb chops were amazing. Like salads, like you'd get these salads. Everything was picked that morning. And they're garnished, because she's super visual and she's a great stylist. They're garnished with these bouquets of like flowers from herbs. So like it's a bouquet of like chive blossoms and basil blossoms, and you know everything is so gorgeous. And there's choreography to it. So there's a moment in the middle of the dinner where like a new round of candles comes out and is placed on your table, and it's just beautiful.
Does she do most of the cooking, or
she
does?
She's the girl. Like
really,
she has people like helping, but
she's really,
really doing it. Yeah.
The show. You
yeah.
have to talk to the other people or at the restaurant?
We did, yeah. And I mean, I think the thing
bad.
Is, if you
sounded great,
if you work that hard to get there, you're going to say it's amazing. But everybody had that really glowy kind of look.
Well, look like there were long tables, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you'd be at a table for like, what, 10 or 12, something like that?
It's, yep. 10 or 12, and it's like a four-hour dinner, so you're in there for the long haul.
Oh, yeah.
So
that would be very exciting.
Can we talk about a few other things you do in season two?
Yeah.
You describe Greensboro, Vermont, which I've never heard of, as the best little food town. Where is it, and why is it?
So it's in Northeast Kingdom, almost to the Canadian border.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually long been a very secret retreat for artists. Like my favorite novelist, Wallace Stegner, used to spend his summers there, and he wrote the book Crossing to Safety. It's based on his life in Greensboro. So there is a thing in Greensboro, but it has become this food hub. There's Jasper Hill cheese, which you may have heard of. They mm-hmm. are one of the top cheese producers in New England. There's Hill Farmstead Brewery, which is the cult brewery of all cult breweries. They've, for the past 5 years, ratebeer.com, which is like the major beer rating site, has named them not just the best brewery in the country, but in the world.
Really?
For 5 years straight.
Wow.
And they're in Greensboro. And then there's a food incubator in a nearby town called Hardwick, where, you know, all these other businesses are getting launched. So it's become this, and, you know, the guys, like, Sean Hill, who he was brewing beer out of, you know, the garage at Hill Farmstead for a while before he, I mean, everybody's cross-pollinating with each other.
So does this mean kind of a fix-up for the Northeast Kingdom, which has traditionally been
poverty-stricken? Listen, I was at Hill Farmstead. There were people there who had driven overnight from Wisconsin with their two-year-old who slept. I mean, they're not abusive parents. Like, they were taking good care of their kid. But this is a major destination for people from around the country. And they show up, and they wait to be called up to the counter to fill their growlers and buy their bottles. And it's like they're coming up to the altar. I mean, there's this reverence. They have their coolers. They're so excited because a lot of these, the beer is pretty much only distributed in Vermont. And to really get the full line, I mean, this is an extensive line of beer. You have to go to the brewery.
Did make reservations at the brewery?
No,
as
you
well?
Can just show up.
Oh, you can just show up. Okay.
Yeah.
And by the way, we should make clear: Weekends with Yankees season two is not just about food, even though that'd be fine with me. Richard does most of the. Here's the world of New England. You do most
there's
of the
adventure,
food.
Adventure. We're out on windjammers.
I don't
we're
care about
hiking
adventure.
In the
I care
White
about
Mountains.
Food. Forget adventure. Can we talk about food?
I'm the food girl.
Here is the most important
very
thing.
Strong
you claim to have found the best lobster roll, and I think I'm going to challenge you, but tell us what it is and why you made that determination.
I got into an RV with my family and a shelter dog that was about 5 days in our care and drove the entire coast of Maine to Canada tasting 4 or 5 lobster rolls a day.
Did you really?
So
that's
I
great.
Stand by
that's
my
great.
Choice. That is a hard-earned
and
choice.
And so why is this? It's McClune's, right?
McClune's.
Why is this the best?
Okay, so not only, I mean, looks are not the thing here, but I will say that this is, if you were to think of the platonic ideal of a lobster shack, you would come up with McClune's. It is absolutely
right on the water
beautiful.
Or something?
On the water. There's a lobster pound right there, view of the islands. It is stunningly beautiful. It's in South Thomaston, Maine, near Rockland, Rockport. But the thing that matters here is, okay, a lobster roll is a very simple thing. It's butter, it's a bun, it's lobster meat, and it's mayo or butter, depending on what you prefer. Those are very simple ingredients, and you need to let each ingredient shine. And the mistake that a lot of lobster shacks make, particularly when they're doing a mayo roll, is they mix the meat with the mayo. Particularly if they're doing high volume, they'll do it in advance. So the meat sits in the mayo, absorbs all that flavor, starts to get mushy. McClune's treats the mayonnaise like a condiment, which is what it is. So they spread it on the inside of the bun. Then they put the meat, this beautiful, very fresh, very sweet meat, right in there. They toast the bun perfectly, crisp on the side. They do the right kind of bun so it gets crisp on the sides with the butter. So you get all the flavors separately, but they also make it the right size. I don't like the overstuffed lobster rolls because I don't want to have to eat it with a fork. Mm-hmm. I want to taste all those simple elements together.
So if the mayo is not in the mixed with the lobster, does that mean the lobster is put in there unadulterated, just lobster meat itself?
Yep, but there's enough mayo on the bun that it's not dry. It's not like a dry roll. It feels very moist, and there's plenty of mayo. It's just that you can taste it separately from the lobster.
But, you know, doesn't that make sense?
It's so
sensible. Yeah, if you have the lobster meat sitting in the mayonnaise, you're absolutely right. I never thought of that.
Also, they don't put lettuce. I just think lettuce has no place in a lobster roll. It gets mushy. Particularly if it's in a warm bun or if it's with the mayonnaise, it gets mushy so quickly, it gets slimy, and the flavor just doesn't go well with lobster.
By the way, the only that sounds fabulous. The only exception I'd make, because we tried it on the air a couple of months ago, did we do it with Corby Comer? I can't remember, is if you have lost all your teeth, the best is McDonald's. Because it's literally, the McDonald's lobster roll is like eating mush.
I bet sits in the mayo for like 3 weeks.
Oh, my God.
Well, that proves Amy's theory, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the roll, I know you know this, because you do
it's
this. The roll is everything, right? Is it not?
Yeah, absolutely.
So where are you on this horrible debate that is elevated, really much higher level than I remember it even 5 years ago, the so-called Connecticut hot with butter deal versus the Maine cold with mayo deal? Where do you fall?
Okay, I have opinions about that, too.
I knew you would, Amy Trevor. So go ahead.
So, I think you have to be very judicious if you're doing the hot buttered style, and that is the original. I mean, Connecticut claims to have invented the lobster roll. I think there's some credible claims there, and it's a legitimate style of a roll. But you have to start with slightly undercooked lobster meat because the Connecticut style is hot. So you're going to reheat that lobster, which is very delicate.
Very good point.
So if you're going to reheat it, you don't want to overcook it, which is too often what happens. I love a really well done Connecticut hot butter roll. But a lot of the times you'll get that dry kind of edge to the meat. It almost gets like a little crispy on the edges. That's a problem. The challenge in Maine, actually, is Maine lobster shacks will give you butter, but they tend to go more toward the mayo style. So the meat is always very cold. And when you put that butter on the cold meat, it congeals and it gets pretty gross. So if you want to get a butter roll in Maine, you need to ask them to, like, maybe not warm it, but at least, like, take the chill off a little bit before you order it.
Okay, you must cook a lot of lobsters.
I do, although I am a wimp about it.
Yeah, I was going to ask guilty. You. I do, too. But I never do it. I make somebody else do it.
Well, and have you done the... I've done the thing where you put the knife... It's supposed to be more humane to kill them instantly with the knife.
That's what the... Yeah.
But then they thrash around. Like an Annie Hall moment.
Yeah. I know. But then you hear them banging against the lobster pot.
You feel terrible.
Is that what you were going to ask her about?
I was going to ask you how you cook them.
Sadism? You can put them in the freezer, which kind of puts them to sleep.
Right.
And you can stroke their bellies, which is supposed to relax them.
Before you murder them.
You can take off the rubber band. Some people feel that the rubber band's on the claws. Obviously, you have to be careful so you don't get bit. But some say it kind of mars the flavor. The rubber flavor gets into
it. I tell you, after someone told us on the show, and I can't remember... If that thing that I thought was ridiculous, the massage of the belly thing and really almost hypnotizes them. I happened to be with Roger Berkowitz, I don't know, 2 days later, and I asked him, from Legal Seafood, obviously, and I asked him if it was BS, and he said it's totally legit and it works.
Yeah.
It really practically hypnotizes.
But if somebody gives you a good massage and then sends you to the guillotine,
I didn't ask him that question.
I feel like a total sadist.
It doesn't take long for the adrenaline to start pumping.
Yeah, before you get attached
to the
lobster.
You know what I've always done? Because I do it myself. This is tried and true. If you tap the lobster on one claw, it looks to that side, and then you throw it in the other direction and never knew what happened. Or maybe you don't. We're talking to Amy Traverso, who is the co-host with Richard Weiss of Season 2 of Weekends with Yankee that premieres this Sunday at 12:30 in GBH2. Obviously, it's a national show. Do people outside of the six New England states give a damn about what happens in New England?
I am amazed. So we knew that at Yankee, half of our readers are from outside New England.
I didn't know that, really.
Yeah, and we get actually our most passionate letters from readers come from people who've moved away and they miss it, so they love the magazine. But we are in 49 states. Wyoming's the one holdout.
For the TV thing?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we got far more coverage and higher ratings than we ever would have thought, and particularly outside of New England.
That's great.
It's been a great surprise.
So you get that thing, 12 classic New England recipes, and right away you think of clam chowder, of course.
Right.
But you go right through. You got the Boston cream pie. You got the homemade brown bread. Now, did you make these recipes, Amy?
I've made all of those recipes, mm-hmm. yes. And we like to go through and sort of periodically just even update the list of what are the iconic New England recipes right now? And,
What are the iconic recipes right now?
Right now I would say, there's a big bread revival. So things like even brown bread is sort of coming back. New England used to be the breadbasket of America, and a lot of the grain from America, early America, was grown in Vermont. And then, of course, the Midwest could kind of outperform with their large, flat fields.
Yes.
But there's a revival now where we're seeing grains being grown in Vermont, Western Massachusetts, and more bakeries are now baking with locally. They're milling their own flour. That's a big thing right now, milling your own flour. And they are milling local grain. And so you're getting this. We visited a place for the show, Elmore Bakery up in Vermont. They are milling their own flour with local grain and making these gorgeous breads. They're just incredible.
Why is milling the flour a big deal
now?
It's
fresher. So you're getting all the oils are, they're just perfect. They're just recently extracted. The flavor, there's a farm in Central Mass Western Mass called Four Star Farms. And you can buy their flour all over Boston, like Formaggio Kitchen and Feed and Supply. There's a bunch of places. And you got to try it. I made pancakes with this flour for the first time, and my mind was blown. I did not know you could have that much flavor.
Okay,
what's
the flour again,
Four
please?
Star Farms.
Four Star Farms. Yes. I'm running that down.
And you do cooking stuff on the show, too.
Yeah,
not?
So we added cooking segments this season, so that's a new thing. At the end of every episode, I cook a dish that was sort of inspired by. So we did a clam bake. Like a clam bake would be a classic New England dish. We did one that you can make on your stove at home, on your stovetop, in a big...
Well,
in a big lobster
great.
Pot, you layer seaweed, and if you can get it, you don't have to have the seaweed, but you layer the shellfish and the lobsters and the, potatoes, corn, and then you've got your boil.
When you were mentioning bread a minute ago, I think we were talking in the air either earlier today or yesterday about the smell of bread. We were talking about it with Julie Vogel. What's your favorite smell when you go? If you had to pick one smell going into a restaurant, a retail establishment. What's the one that really knocks your socks off?
It would be sort of something like a cinnamon bunny flavor. Or, you know, do you ever walk into Galleria Umberto in the North End? I feel like I shouldn't even say this because they don't need more publicity. They have more. They just got a Beard Award, one of the sort of the awards they give for kind of local treasures. You know the Beard Awards, but not like Best Chef, but one of those local treasure awards. So it is that pizzeria. It's only open for lunch, and they do the thick Sicilian. There's the steamy, yeasty tomato cheese scent that you get when you walk in there. That
you know, one of these. You know, I'm talking to you two times we've done it. I know this is horrible to say because people always say to us, "You get paid to do this job." That's how I feel about you.
Yeah.
I don't mean that.
No,
I mean, come
on. I say it
to
myself.
Are you kidding me?
It's embarrassing.
It is ridiculous.
I feel like I need to stop and then like spend the rest of my career volunteering.
No, you don't. No, you don't. I think you should enjoy yourself. What the heck? It's a great
show. I saw a couple episodes from the first season. It was great. And we saw some of the lead to season two. And it looks terrific as well. So congratulations to both of you. It's really exciting.
Yeah, it's great. And I think it'll be even more fun than watching a bear come out of hibernation.
No.
I almost guarantee that.
Have you seen the bear cam yet?
No, I haven't.
It's great.
Don't say what you just said until you see it.
I'm
sure your show's going to be great, but it ain't no bear cam.
It's all feet coming out, stretching. You know, it's so funny.
God.
The feet stretching.
If you just tuned in, we started the show talking about this bear cam at Glacier National Park, which with a bear coming out of hibernation that is just otherworldly. It is beautiful.
Amy,
it's great to see you.
Thank you
so
much
for
coming in. I'm really starving now. I have to eat some more of my
lunch. We're excited for the season, too. It's great.
Amy Traverso, senior editor at Yankee Magazine, along with Richard Weiss. She hosts the TV show Weekends with Yankee. Season 2 premieres this Sunday, 12:30 on WGBH2. If you are outside the region, check your local PBS listings for show times. It's all over the country. Thank you very much, Amy. That was great.
Great to see you, Amy.
Coming up. The songs, they are a-changin'. How Bob Dylan is singing songs to the LGBTQ community and making them friendly. Sue O'Connell joins us for that and more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us to take on the social norms and abnormalities of the day is media maven Sue O'Connell. Sue, of course, is thank you, appreciate it. Co-publisher, that was rather sad, of Bay Windows and the South End News.
If you didn't keep saying it was sad, no one at home would know
it was
sad.
Now, Marjorie, why don't you just tell people, well, I'm trying to prepare for the segment so I can do a good job. Mm-hmm. What did you just ask me and Sue?
Yeah.
Like 10 seconds before the segment started.
I asked if you think the car wash would be open today.
I mean, you can't wait till 2 o'clock
really
and make
dirty.
A call?
I just wondered, you know, I'm looking at...
Squirrel!
I had a big plan to go to the car wash today.
Okay, Sue,
nice
really
to see you.
It's really
getting embarrassing. Good to see you, too. It's not open.
Can you check and see if the car wash is open?
I will. If I get my phone over there.
Get back to us in a couple of minutes, please.
So, talk about embarrassing for me about the car wash. Pretty embarrassing how much time you spent online.
Oh, don't go into
looking
this.
At the pictures of the architecture professor... From
we're going to lead with
you're
that,
talking
huh?
about me.
Of all and the news that I did
yeah.
too. What's the problem here?
And why would Jim Browdy and many other Americans have basically crashed the internet by looking at this picture of this gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous architect? Why don't you describe how she looks, Jim?
Well, why don't you describe why we're talking about
it? Well, Sue's going to tell us.
Brad Pitt is doing what there, Sue?
He
O'Connell.
Is dating, allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly dating an MIT professor mm-hmm. who is also a well-known architect in the area, and this woman is just drop-dead gorgeous and smart and talented. And, I mean, I think if you're going to date somebody after Jennifer Aniston and Angelina Jolie, you got to be right up there, you know?
Well, I hadn't even noticed what she looked like, actually.
I know. You say to yourself, it just isn't fair, though, to be that good-looking and that brilliant.
You know,
well, he's
just,
pretty good-looking
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not like he's down the bottom of the barrel.
He's
and, you know,
not
he
an
has,
MIT professor.
No,
that's
but,
true.
He,
she's
no,
the MIT
but
professor.
He has a thing about architecture because he and Angelina Jolie, after Katrina, remember, went down to New Orleans.
Oh, that's right.
And they
that's
moved
right.
the whole family there, and they rebuilt a number of the neighborhoods. And he is very, very, Brad Pitt, interested in sustainable economic housing and building environmentally friendly buildings.
Didn't he create a nonprofit?
Yes.
Which is theoretically the reason why he met this MIT professor.
Right. Now, they have a shared, not only are they both beautiful, but they have a shared interest.
That's great.
I was so busy looking at the pictures of this absolutely gorgeous MIT professor, Neri Oxman, that I didn't really look into as I should have. Why did Brad and Angelina break up?
Well, you know, they called me, and they told me, Angie said to me, well, you have to know the narrative, the origin story.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Brad, who was with Jennifer Aniston,
and
Jennifer just wanted to have babies and smoke marijuana, allegedly, and just have a nice life in Beverly Hills.
I thought he wanted to have babies and smoke marijuana.
Well, they
kind
of, but then he went off and he fell in love with Angelina, who was trying to save the world and had a deeper meaning, and, you know, Brad allegedly had a drinking problem and would lose his temper around the kids because the way Angie raises the kids is a very free-to-be, you-and-me sort of way, and Brad was a more traditionally raised, so he, you know, had some issues with the troop of the way he was raised, she was raising, or they were raising the troop of kids.
Oh.
Can I tell you
and
something?
They just fell
Well, you've
out
had
of love.
A phenomenal media career in radio, TV, and print. If anybody should have been the editor of Page Six,
I know
it is
I
you
know.
In the New York
totally,
Post.
Totally, totally.
And you know, I mean
this.
That as a compliment,
yes,
not as
yes.
a.
I spend way too much time worrying about Brad and Angie. I'll tell you.
Well, they were sort of the quintessential couple. I never saw that movie, Mrs. Smith or Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Oh, they were great. They had great chemistry. When they have chemistry together, like you don't know what chemistry is. It's kind of like the chemistry Jim and I have
it's
together.
That's
like,
right.
You see it.
You
know it.
You know it. Okay.
I've been saying. Okay.
A big laugh out of that.
So I'm going to play. I'm going to play sound.
Okay.
For you, from Bob Dylan. I don't know if we'll be able to understand what he says, but it is from a CD by the name of Universal Love. I think it's being released today, and you have to tell me what is unusual about it. So, Colin, sort of like a quiz, here is Bob Dylan.
I'm not much to look at, nothing to see, just glad I'm living, lucky to be. I've got a man crazy for me. He's funny that way.
He actually sounds
I
fabulous.
I know, it's amazing.
He really
it
sounds
does.
Great.
Better than ever.
So why are we even bothering to play that, I guess, Frank Sinatra song?
Yes. Which was originally titled She's Funny That Way.
Exactly.
And originally had female pronouns in it. And our friends over at MGM Resorts International have decided that they are tired of playing music for their same-sex wedding celebrations, of which I think they have 20% to 30% of the ceremonies at their properties are same-sex marriage ceremonies. So they have asked some famous singers like Dylan and Kesha if they would re-record some songs that were our love songs that and sing with the same-sex pronoun in it. So, for example, "And I Love Him." Used to be "And I Love Her" by the Beatles,
right.
And
I've
they're
heard of
sung
them.
They're
by a great group,
great group, and that's by Kesha. And it's a way to both cater to their audience, their commercial audience, which again, in the LGBT civil rights battle, the Fortune 500 companies have been very much the ones leading the way, and people like Bob Dylan, who are not gay or lesbian, are thrilled to participate.
You know, one of the things I didn't understand when I was reading the first story I saw about this. They mentioned how unusual it was, and that even people like Sam Smith, who has one of the most beautiful voices of any person on the planet, and I think you could argue is one of the highest profile gay, maybe bisexual, but gay singers in the world, doesn't use
They don't do it.
Same
Melissa
gender.
Melissa Etheridge, Katie Lang, if you go back.
Because it doesn't sell? Is that?
Yeah, it's the market, you know. So they don't want, if they're going to be openly gay and they're going to be singing, they need to reach the mass market, and they don't want to, like, make it a gay, I'm using air quotes right now, a gay song, right?
Wow.
So it's a challenge, and I think that's part of the reason why you have mostly heterosexual people singing these songs now. So
that's interesting on Universal Love.
Yep,
that's
Universal
right.
Love.
And the CD's out today. I think the idea is great. I love it. And boy, is that the best he has sounded?
It is. It's like
years?
He's singing.
It is like he's singing.
I know.
Exactly.
I know. Usually you can't understand a word he says.
At least in recent years.
Yeah. Well, you know, when he was young, you can't understand a word he said. What's going on with Grindr?
Well, let me get my phone and I'll let you know how I'm going to do it. Grindr, of course, is a dating app mostly for gay men who are looking for Mr. Right Now. Not right. Mr. Right, but Mr. Right
we got,
Now.
We got there,
right
you.
At this second. Somebody, never mind, I was going to make a joke about the library, but I won't. But anyway, Grindr has done a terrible, terrible thing, and they have released the HIV status of their users, which is public. Like people put it in their profile. I am so and so. I am looking for such and such. I am HIV positive or I am HIV negative. Yeah. But they have done this sort of Cambridge Analytica thing and made this data and location information and all of this available to advertisers as well as third-party people. Grindr has kind of apologized, but they're saying, listen, it's public. It was on your profile. It shouldn't be a secret, but this is, and they haven't violated any of the HIPAA laws, you know, the privacy issues around medical status, again, because they're not a medical provider. They're a dating app. They're a hookup app. So again, here we are in this brave new world where, you know, people are just happily putting their information up online, up on the application, you know, where they are, where they live, what other apps they're using and their HIV status, and it's being shared with people, I would say without their permission, but you kind of give your permission when you do this, so it's without their knowledge.
Well, you know, but kind of give your permission when you do this. It gives me an opportunity to discuss something I was trying to figure out where to fit in the show, and this is perfect, including data sharing, because that, in my opinion, is horrible. As much trouble as Mark Zuckerberg is in, this to me is 10 times worse.
Oh, this is terrible.
There's a story on CNBC this morning, I think it's this morning, maybe it was yesterday, saying that until all the crap with Cambridge Analytica arose about a month ago or how many weeks ago it was, Facebook was in negotiation with hospitals to get health data on people that it could match up with their users. Now, the theoretical reason was because we want to make do analysis that helps people who have less access to healthcare have better access. If you buy that, and they said the data would be transferred anonymously. But in the same sentence, they acknowledge they wanted to be able to make matches. And after the Cambridge Analytica thing, does anybody believe that the promise of anonymity, the notion that they were going to buy and then use and potentially sell healthcare data on their
users appalling.
Is beyond
and
appalling.
And listen, as upsetting as the Facebook stuff is, this app stuff, the more I learn about the apps that we have in our pocket and how our apps are following us, and which, you know, even things like Waves, which we want them to follow us and tell us where we're going, but using the data, we've agreed to give everyone the data. I've been in the sort of state of mind, which I've now changed, that there's been so much data, how could they personally use it against me, right? If they have 80 million profiles or 80 billion profiles, how are they going to use my particular data in any way to get me? But when we get into this medical stuff and the location stuff, you know, that's the part that really starts
yeah,
to be
scary. And you also think
scary.
That is it that many steps away to find out you're trying to get a job and, oh, well, this person is HIV positive. They're going to cost
but at the same time,
more insurance.
If you have a Grindr account... And you say it's a public account for the most part. And what you can do, because I've been on Grindr for business purposes, you can, if I turned on my Grindr right now and had a profile, I could tell who in the audience and who in the library was on Grindr. And I could basically just walk around and find the Grindr person. That's how it works.
You see their picture?
Whatever they put up is a picture. Yes, so that's how it works. You find the people who are
because
around
it's a GPS
you.
Connection.
It's a GPS connection, and I'm looking for Mr. Right Now, not Mr. Right. So I could go on Grindr, I put up, say I'm available, and then I could see all the people in the building and out on Boylston Street who are near me, who are available, and then we could make a plan to have coffee.
You know, only good news out of this
coffee
whole discussion.
Coffee is a euphemism
about Grindr and this Facebook health thing.
Yeah,
is I assume people know that Zuckerberg has agreed to testify in front of Congress, and it's next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday.
Talk about great time, perfect timing for hopefully Congress people are actually concerned about information rather than grandstanding. To find out what's going on. We're talking to Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows in the South End News.
Well, this is a story that shows that the initial information may be absolutely inaccurate because we all remember back in the terrible Pulse nightclub massacre in Orlando, Florida, where 49 people were killed. One of the original theories was that the shooter was a self-hating gay guy who was a Muslim, but his wife was on trial for knowing about the account, about the attack and doing nothing. She was acquitted. Very abused wife, from everything I've learned. And now the theory is that that had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I think I'm not completely believe that he was not engaging in at least some homosexual curiosity, if you will.
Because he was there.
He was there
beforehand.
A lot. The people in the bar knew him. Men in the bar knew him. excuse me. And felt that they felt that he was closeted, and that's why he was coming to the bar on a regular basis. Whether or not he acted out on that is irrelevant in some way. But I think it does go to the bigger issue, which is in so many, the vast majority of these shootings and these violent acts, domestic violence is
absolutely
at the root of almost every single one of them. And that if we could work better as a society to identify domestic abusers, get domestic abusers and their families help, and not let them have access to weapons, a lot of the violence that we experience would be diminished, because the domestic violence is the root in almost every single act of violence that we experience in this country.
Yeah, absolutely true. You know, even here in this most recent case in Parkland, Florida, this boy mistreated his girlfriend, allegedly.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a good point. Okay, let's get to Perez Hilton.
We actually have sound from Perez Hilton.
Yeah, let's...
Everybody knows who he is. Here's a Perez Hilton saying something that has engendered, I'd say, a tad of controversy. Here's Perez.
If my son turns out to be gay, or if he's already gay and not able to articulate that because he's only 5, I will love my son unconditionally and support him. If my son is transgender, I will love him and support him unconditionally. However, if I had my preference, I would prefer my son to be heterosexual because that's easier.
Look at the look on Sue's face.
If I had my preference, I would like Perez Hilton not to be gay so that we could... I'm like, he's just... Perez is the National Enquirer of the gay world, right? His website for years has just trafficked in the low of the low of the most unconfirmed, mean-spirited gossip you can imagine. And while I certainly say I think every parent would love to say, I want my child to grow up and have the least troubled life that they could possibly have. I don't want my son or daughter to be president. I want them to be a member of the Chamber of Commerce and own an insurance company and not, you know, have a wild and crazy big life. I think that that's something that parents share. But he's just an awful parent.
Well, the thing that really upset me, because I do think, particularly, and I've heard this actually from parents who do have gay sons, the thing they're worried about most, they want grandchildren. And they are, you know, is my son going to give me any grandchildren, especially if they have one son and the son is gay? And a lot of times they
go adopt a kid. There are two people standing up here who know a little bit about that.
Exactly. But there is, let's be honest, a genetic kind of thing. I want to see my little genes.
And there's also a death of the life that you had envisioned for your child when your child chooses or is of a different orientation.
But the thing that really bothered me that he said, which is incredible to me for a gay guy, that he said he'd not put his son in a dance class.
Yeah, he wouldn't encourage his son. He wouldn't encourage his son to take dance unless his son wanted to take dance because he didn't want to, you know,
make him gay.
Perez is an awful human. He's an awful human being.
So I'm glad we brought him up.
Yeah, he's an awful, awful human being.
Why did we bring him up?
I have no idea. It was your idea.
You know.
But the thing is, he's playing into one of the worst stereotypes.
Exactly.
You decide to be gay because you're in a dance class. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, right. And again, I think everyone would like their kid to be the most vanilla human being on the face of the earth so that they don't have any challenges with them. But at the same time, you know, and he's putting his kid in the media. He's putting his kid on his website without his kid's consent. You know, the kid's a baby, and now he has to live with this soundbite following him for the rest of his life. He's an awful parent.
When you two are talking about Perez Hilton, all I can think about, which I assume is all the two of you can think about, is what does Neri Oxman think about this? I mean, isn't that what I'm thinking about right now.
Is he absolutely gorgeous?
I'm going to try and get my kid to go to MIT so that we can
talk about architecture. Really, can you imagine?
Let's move on.
This is stereotyping away, but you don't think MIT is necessarily the place where everybody's gorgeous. You know what I mean? You think they're really brainy.
That's not right.
Because you don't...
I mean, it's a stereotype.
We're just going to let her flap in the wind on that one, aren't we?
Brilliant and geniuses. Mm-hmm, you don't think necessarily get lucky in two parts.
Well, look
you know?
At Jim and I. Well, look, we're both
exactly. That's what I would have said.
Gorgeous. Okay. Come on.
Sue O'Connell, it's great to see you as you. Always.
Sue O'Connell is co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. She joins us.
Oh, that's
regularly.
Right.
Look at that.
Thank you very much.
From the audience, Sue O'Connell. Thank you very much. Coming up, it is time for our Friday news quiz. Our quiz is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting, as we do every Friday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Boston Public Radio. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, and we're going to take you back to the 70s by way of, obviously, the old school game show. It's a trivia show, a variety show with a splash of burlesque and a retro vibe. Joining us are the people who helped make it happen, writer and announcer Will Smalley. Say hello, Will.
Hello, Will.
Hello to you. Exactly. And Nick Chambers, a cast member and writer. Nick, great to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us. Thank
you. Well, it's my pleasure.
That's my thing.
I like that very much.
And as we all know, starting about a month ago, we have lifelines for our contestants.
Yes, we do.
If they can't answer a question or they get it wrong, they get help. And our lifelines today are Judy and Peter from Hopkinton. Where are you? You are Judy and Peter.
There's
Hi, Judy.
Judy and
Peter. Waving to you. And by
Hi.
The way, they just moved there, and they took the commuter rail this morning, which means it's incredible they ever got here. And it is great to see you. Peter, say something quickly. Say hello.
Hello.
That was excellent. Judy, do you want to expand on that or no?
We're so excited to be here.
Are you really?
This has been my dream. I listen to you all the time. Oh. And we've recently retired, and I said to him, one of the things on my bucket list is to take the train into Boston and see this show.
Oh, my God.
So I've said to Peter many times, this is like a dream come true for me.
That is fabulous. So Will and Nick,
and
you
the
can
train was on the train.
The train was on time.
It was?
Yes.
Let's hope it is going back.
Yeah. We don't care about going back. We only care about getting here.
You know,
it's great to meet you both.
We're on a bucket list.
We are.
That's very impressive.
Thank you.
So we
can help them.
Yeah, that's absolutely. You can help them. So tell people that don't know, Will or Nick, either one of you can answer this. What is the old school game show, and what's burlesque?
Oh, I mean, that's old school game show is an interactive theater game show where the audience gets called up, kind of like Price is Right style. Mike D'Angelo and Ginny Nightshade are the creators and producers of the show. Mike is the host, crazy energetic and lovely man. But yeah, it's 70s style trivia kind of all put into a game show with, there's, like I said, there's burlesque, there's sketch, there's comedy, there's live band, there's singing, there's dancing, there's confetti. It's an amazing time.
And you guys are the stars of this too.
I'm a part of the cast, so yeah. I play various parts. I do different games.
I'm strictly the announcer and help write and produce the show.
I always wanted to be an announcer. In all seriousness, that was one of my great dreams. How do you feel about being the announcer?
We're both stand-up comedians as well, mm-hmm. but this gig is like my favorite thing I do.
Is it really?
Yeah.
There's no show like it in the city at all. Like, you have to just come check it out.
Well, can we get to something that really, when you said it's like an audience participate, that gives me hives. And I want to understand something. There's nothing that makes me more anxious than I walk in something I want to see, and I'm worried that I'm going to be included against my will.
Oh, yeah.
Do most people want to be part of the show?
You sign up for it.
You do.
Yeah. So if you want to play, you play.
If you're a coward like me,
you won't have a game show thrust upon you.
That's exactly what. Thank you.
So
before we welcome cowards.
So before we start the show, Nick from WISA.
Start the game, we call it.
The game, whatever it is.
Yes, quiz.
Where did you do your first stand-up comedy?
Right here in Boston.
Yeah, where?
It's a place that's not there anymore.
What's it called?
Such is the nature of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, what's it called?
It was Remington's. Dick Doherty had a room down there.
How scary was it the first time?
I employed a lot of liquid courage, so I don't know. But it went well, and I'm kept up with it.
How about you, Will?
The first time I did stand-up comedy was actually in Hull, Massachusetts. I don't recommend going to Hull if you want to break into stand-up comedy.
No?
No.
People aren't that funny down there, or what?
It was like a bar show, it was a horrible night where there was teachers, and they got on stage, and they almost attacked us. It was, yeah, it was.
Teachers attacked you? Why would teachers attack you?
Liquid courage. They were drinking as well.
Okay.
You know, I don't want you both to think I'm even more neurotic than I actually am. In light of what I said before, if you had to say to me, what's the last thing I'd want to do in the whole world because of the anxiety level, it's be a stand-up comedian. When you tell your first joke, and nobody laughs.
That just happened to us, Jim.
We actually did an event where that happened a couple of nights. Yep. We're not going to say where.
Embarrassing.
We bombed. I mean, we couldn't have been worse.
Right.
And you
Jim gave me all the lines. I
did,
point
actually.
That out.
How do you recover? What is in your metabolism or your genes that allows you to recover from a lack of laughter on what you know is a killer line to open your performance? Nick, you can go first. Go ahead. What is it? What do you do?
If you know there are some jokes that I've been telling for years that just doesn't get a response, but I like it, so I've...
So you don't give a damn?
It took a while to get there.
That's
but
great.
I think like building up that tolerance to knowing, like, all right, I'm working towards something and I have the ability, and eventually you'll get there.
And what's your deal?
I think it's like the promise of another show. really, because it's like we've both had amazing shows, and that will trump any negative feeling always for me, like knowing that this can go great, and that feeling and having the audience with you, you know, through laughter, through silence, through whatever, knowing they're on board with you, that's a really cool feeling.
See, that gets us through. We had a good radio show a couple of months ago, so we figure we'll probably have another good one in a couple of months, so it'll be fine.
Okay,
should we do the quiz? Who are you asking the first question?
I'll start with Nick, because he's from Worcester.
Okay.
Even though I'm from Fall River, and they used to have a lot in common, but I think Worcester's improved dramatically.
There's nothing wrong with Fall River, Marjorie.
Yeah, no, it's
fine.
I went to Worcester recently, and I was surprised. I always thought Worcester liked Fall River, but you've moved up in Worcester, I think.
I think we're all doing great.
I think we're all doing great, okay.
Now, Nick, don't forget, if you need help from either Judy or Peter, you just ask, and you'll get a lifeline.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Here we go, Nick. This week on Twitter, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee compared his recent colonoscopy to an event in the headlines. What did he tweet? Multiple choice.
Okay.
A, had a colonoscopy today? My doctor might be Robert Mueller. He was digging around for ages and didn't find anything. B, had a colonoscopy today? My doctor was actually Russian. Now that is what I call Russian meddling. Or there's two more. C, had a colonoscopy today. My doctor said even Scott Pruitt would want to regulate these emissions. And D, had a colonoscopy today. My doctor said, call the White House. We found the source of the leaks.
Those are horrible, actually. Ooh.
The first one is the only one that, I mean, knowing the comedy stylings of Mike Huckabee, the first one sounds like... That's what it might be.
You want to make a guess? You want to make a guess?
He just did. He guessed A.
He guessed A. Well, is that your guess?
Well, it's too late. Thank you very much. Who's the lifeline? Excuse me. Let's get to the lifelines. Who's the lifeline here for Nick? Who is it, Judy or Peter? Peter, is it you?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, apparently it is.
That's what my wife said.
He was supposed to get the lifeline before he answered the question.
No, it doesn't matter. Well, you can play it by ear. Go ahead.
What's any good if it's after you answer the question.
Go ahead.
Huckabee's doctor wasn't Russian. The procedure.
Oh, that is too much of a giveaway.
You see that?
So,
want to make another guess?
That's an additional hint.
A was Mueller, B was Russian meddling, 3 was Scott Pruitt, and 4 was called the White House. We found the source of the leak.
So I'll go with B.
Very good. There you go.
We can't have clues like that. So you got a point, sort of. Here's your deal. After ongoing emergency heart surgery, I guess this is a medical quiz, Arnold Schwarzenegger, remember him?
Oh, yeah.
Came out of anesthesia in character saying which of these things? A.
It's not a tumor. Not a tumor at all.
B.
Crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and they hear the lamentation of their women.
Or C.
I'm back.
Is it A, B, or we're not playing them again, so don't even think about it.
No.
A, B, or C?
I think I know it, but just because she's so excited.
Oh, yes. Judy?
Yeah, Judy.
Judy, this
Go
is
ahead,
your
Judy.
Opportunity. Don't blow this, Judy, let me tell you. Go ahead.
Arnold would have terminated the surgeon if he had botched the procedure.
Oh, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good.
Well, so what's the answer?
I'm going to say it's C.
You
Excellent.
Are correct.
Judy, nicely done.
Thanks,
Thank
Judy.
You very much.
Very good. Okay, Nick, you ready?
Yes, I don't know.
First Lady of the U.S. Treasury, Louise Linton, stars in a long-awaited film coming out later this year. It is A, Serial Daters Anonymous, featuring Linton as a fashion blogger with a broken heart who dishes the dirt on awful dates she goes on after a breakup. Or B, Let Them Eat Hashtags, a modern twist on the story of Marie Antoinette, with Linton as an Instagram influencer with a big following and a small heart.
By the way, he may not get the answer. He's going to use that in his routine, though. It's pretty obvious. He liked that.
That is, if that, I think it's.
Hold on.
Wait, there's more.
I
know that was a great
sneezing.
One.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Continue.
Or C, 101 Pandas, Linton stars as a pampered and glamorous heiress in search of the perfect fur coat.
Okay. I think it's the first one. If all right.
You did.
But I do want to fund those other two.
Yeah.
We can get those
They're
other two.
They're all good.
Made.
We have a little clip from Serial Daters Anonymous. Here it is.
Oh, boy.
Well, what do you plan on doing with yourself?
Well, I already started a blog.
A blog?
It just sounds like you're going to hurt a lot of people.
You're trying your hardest to make me sound really bad, aren't you?
No, I don't need to try.
Is that a real thing? You judges. Is that real?
I guess so.
Oh, my God. She's the one. Remember when they were posing with all the dollars?
Yeah.
And she had her black gloves and the whatever kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Will, it appears to be a 2-1. This is a guy from
the old school
game show. Let's call it there. By the way, where are you doing this old school game show?
We perform at the Wilbur Theater. We've done it at the Somerville Theater. Oberon in Cambridge
is one
of our favorite venues. If anyone wants to contact us, we're doing private and corporate gigs as well. So go to oldschoolgameshow.com.
Ooh.
Yeah.
You can sign up for the mailing list there, and then you can find out when the next show is going to
be. Yeah,
love that. So here's your opportunity to tie this thing up, I think. A 13-year-old boy spent 12 hours trapped in a network of sewage pipes.
Oh.
This is true, by the way.
Oh.
Okay.
How was he rescued? A first responder lowered a hose. B, there are four choices, by the way. Donald Trump lowered his tie. C, don't laugh at the answers, Jim. A dog walker lowered a chain, which she made by linking a bunch of dog leashes together. D, on a bar, which is Rubino backwards. That's an inside joke. Don't ask.
Okay.
Okay, is it A, B, C, or D?
Please? Do I still get a lifeline again?
Well, if you want. You are really being nice. Who is the lifeline in this particular instance for Will? Judy, it's you again?
Yeah.
Is this like the best experience of your whole life or what? I mean, is this... It's unbelievable for us, too. Okay, go ahead, Judy. What's your lifeline there for Will?
Ready? When he told his classmates what happened to him, they said, "No way, Hose A."
Oh, man. That was beautifully delivered, too, but far better than your husband. Go ahead. What is the answer there?
I'm going to say it's A, hose.
That is really
very good.
Insightful.
Very good.
On your part there. So do any – I'm sorry to obsess on this one thing before we get to the bonus round. First of all, judges, do we thank Judy and Peter at this point?
Yep, we do.
Judy and Peter,
you
are both fabulous.
Thank
Let's
you very
hear
much.
It for them.
Yeah.
By the way, it was
job.
On our bucket list to have you two come to the show. I want you to know that. What are you going to say, Peter?
Just wanted to say, Jim, I'm very impressed how you can stay on your feet throughout the whole show.
So am I. Thank you very much, Peter, for that contribution. So when people choose to participate in the show, which, as I told you, I would not be doing, do they regret it after the show is over, Will? Go ahead.
So here's what I find is people regret.
Tell the truth.
I'm being
okay,
absolutely
fine.
Serious.
I want to make sure you're
People come in with the same feeling that you have, like, I don't want to be a part of it.
Not a chance.
They come see the show, and they say, oh, I could do that next time.
Really?
I swear to God. It's like welcoming. It's easy. It's not stressful at all.
Raise your right hand when you say this. I want to see if it's the truth. Nick is raised. They're both raising their hand. Go
well,
keep them up.
The thing is that when you see somebody not get an answer correctly that you know, it's like a lot of pop culture things. And when someone's like, "You don't know John Cusack? Are you kidding me?"
Are you good at trivia? Do you like know?
I'm good at trivia when I'm not on the spot. Sort of like when
like
you're at home doing Jeopardy, you get
Jeopardy.
All the questions,
right?
And if you're ever on Jeopardy, you probably pee your pants, as the expression goes. You know that expression?
It's a good one.
Jeopardy, okay, fine. So here's our bonus round, gentlemen. Our guests clearly know a lot about old school game shows. But this week's bonus round will test their knowledge of a new school game show, specifically the internet phenomenon HQ, a live trivia game you play on your phone. It's 2-2, gentlemen, as we enter the bonus round.
Okay, we're going to mix up now. I'm going to start with you, Will, this time. Ready?
Okay.
Okay, HQ host Scott Rogowski's signature catchphrase is actually a lyric from the band Phish. What is it? A, let's get down to the nitty-gritty. Let's get this show on the road. B, set your gear shift to the high position of your soul. Or C, look who's in the freezer, Uncle Ebenezer.
I'm not going to fool. This. I know it. It's A.
It's A. You are right.
Are you a big
Very
Phish fan?
Good.
No, but my boyfriend has made me play HQ.
So you knew in advance?
Well, that's knowledge.
Well, that is knowledge. That's what knowledge is. I forgot. That is what knowledge in advance is. That's a very good point.
Otherwise, it's guessing.
That's a very good point. Thank you for that. Okay, let's see if you have any knowledge,
Nick.
Have
you played HQ?
I have not.
Oh, no.
Well, you're in deep.
Oh, no, you're in trouble.
Here's your question there, Nick. What high-profile newsman famously won a game of HQ? Oh, I actually know the answer to this. Of HQ on Christmas Eve with his family. A, CNN host, Red Sox superfan, and Dorchester boy, John King. He's on our show every Tuesday. B, former CBS Evening News anchor Dan Rather, or my favorite, myself, Jim Browdy, host of the award-winning Greater Boston. Is it John King, Dan Rather, or me?
I believe that it is. I'm looking for hints from either of your facial expressions.
No, and Judy and Peter are gone, so forget about it.
I'm gonna go to B.
Oh, great.
Wow, you got it.
Dan Rather. That was very good.
On Christmas Eve or something with his family.
I know.
Okay, this is the one that will decide everything.
Okay, all right.
So good luck to you. What's the score, Jim?
3-3.
Okay, here we go. Well, which of the following nicknames does Scott Rogowski use to refer to himself on the show? A, Quizzy McGuire. B, the bad and bougie Bob Barker. C, the Semitic Pat Sajak.
That's pretty good.
Or D, all of the above.
Oh.
Take your time. Oh. This is for all the marbles.
He talks a mile a minute. I'm going to say it's D, all the above.
You are right.
Congratulations.
Oh, my gosh. That was very impressive.
So you depressed, Nick, about the loss? You got crushed.
I lost?
Yeah, you did. You did, actually.
I never lose because I'm on Old School Game Show. Check oldschoolgameshow.com for our next show.
Yeah. And what are you guys doing this weekend?
I'm actually not performing this weekend.
You're not performing this weekend.
It's a WrestleMania weekend, so I'm
really?
I wouldn't pass that
up. Oh, very good.
Are you?
Are you doing WrestleMania this weekend, or are you doing something else?
Am I doing WrestleMania?
Yeah.
No, I'm not in WrestleMania.
You're not.
This weekend.
What's the website one more time, and then
it's
get the hell
out of here? It's oldschoolgameshow.com. You can find out about all our shows. There's videos. Nick is an amazing. He sings, and he's done videos for us.
I watched him this morning.
Yeah.
You're actually great. You were
Thank
great.
You.
Are great, but whatever. You were great, too.
So, yeah, contact us if you want
great.
To do a corporate or a private gig, and
fabulous
come
to meet
see
you
us.
Both.
Yeah,
well,
thank you so much.
You guys are great, good sports.
Here for
you
Nick
very
and Will,
much.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Will Smalley and Nick Chambers are part of the Old School Game Show, a raucous and rowdy trivia and variety show with a retro vibe. Will Smalley is a writer and announcer. Nick Chambers is a cast member and writer. Thanks again for coming in. And to learn more about these guys, as Will just said, but we'll repeat it, want to find out about upcoming shows or private gigs, go to oldschoolgameshow.com. I want to give you a little programming note before we leave. Today at the Boston Public Library through Sunday, April 8th, there are a series of events as part of the Boston National Poetry Month Festival. If you want to learn more about that and about the poets participating in event times, you go to bostonnationalpoetry.org. I want to thank everybody for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much, everybody that came
thank
down to the
all
library.
For coming,
really appreciate
everybody. We appreciate
people coming
it.
Here a lot. Tune in on Monday for our politics roundup. We've got the poet Richard Blanco is here with a special tribute to National Poetry Month, which we just talked about, and our TV guru, Bob Thompson. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Molly Boygon, Christina Bieni, our engineer, John the Claw Parker. Jim Browdy is not on TV tonight, but Emily Rooney is, 7 o'clock, WGBH Channel 2. That's right, Jim will be back on Monday. Emily Rooney at 7 o'clock tonight if you want to catch her. Basic Black, 7:30 if you want to catch that. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in.
Thanks for listening.
Please tune again on Monday and have a wonderful weekend. And enjoy the snow. It's really lovely for April. Bye.